morning to everyone. Well, we certainly have three new people here in the committee this morning, two as members of Parliament who were sworn in. One of them made his maiden speech yesterday. And our researcher who's new, and also the our professional Girl Friday in this case, who does everything, including just getting me a cup of rooibos tea, thanks. You can just do that. So, we'd like to certainly, in the first instance, welcome the new members of the committee. They both, well, remember we said goodbye to Honourable Maria. We said goodbye to Honourable Van der Westhuizen, do you remember? And they've gone, Honourable Van der Westhuizen, to higher education. And although I know they call themselves yourself shadow ministers, I thought he was more the shadow minister for Cipro, but anyway, could never work out, you know, just what he was shadowing. But anyway, then, and then we. No, he knows I'm going to say that. I think it's my very good letter. And then we also have, of course, the Mr. Honourable Maria. He tells me he's gone to economic development. And I think he's going to enjoy it. We have certainly capacitated him. He can take what he's learned there. But in their place, some of them are perhaps alive. I would certainly like to welcome the leader of that group, if I'm not mistaken, is the Honourable Tim Harris. Is that right? He is eminently qualified, a researcher, and I see he cut his teeth yesterday in politics. You're very welcome. And then your colleague, Honourable Jacques Smoller. Is that right? Smoller. Well, you know, everyone in South Africa is spelling their French, pronouncing their French names differently, eh? And Belgian names. But we're going to Belgium. I'm going to Brussels a week or two, and I've been doing an intensive course on French. So I would hope when I come back to get your name pronounced correctly. But you're very welcome. We expect hard work. I see. Certainly, Honourable Harris, you certainly made yourself available on time. Thank you. And I'm sure you're going to be shadowing your colleague who sees here. The other person, of course, who is new is, I'm not going to get this right. Never mind French. I can barely pronounce Xhosa. So I know Zulu well. But we're going to try Mr. Zabeli. That's close enough. Please say you pronounce it himself. It's not Shisha or Tisha, you know, but how was it again? Yeah, you see, now we all have to take calls on Corsa for that. But he is our new researcher. Another highly qualified young man. All of these are young men. Young men coming in. They don't have to look at a retirement policy, although I believe it's best to look at it before 30. And just want a few geriatrics around, you know, just to get that point. But anyway, our researcher has a degree, an honours degree from Western Cape, from the University of Fort Hare in the Eastern Cape. And some of you know some of our finest qualified people came from Fort Hare and are coming from Fort Hare. And may I say that London University considers their economics department, well, did a few years back, I think it was 5 years ago or 10 years ago, a vast improvement on some of the rubbish coming out of this, even though that's my alma mater. But of course, I understand this has pulled up their shoes and socks and whatever.
He worked for 2 years at the Provincial Department of Agriculture in the Agro, or the Agri-Economic Research Unit, which we know he wants the agriculture research side, and then he went to the Western Cape Department of Economic Development and Tourism in the Trade and Sector Development Research Unit. And he tells me he's now starting his master's, eager to learn all these things, and I told him, well, a lot of us are busy doing doctorates, masters, and half a dozen other things, but we have to kind of fit it in between our portfolio committees. And of course, he knows he'll be getting up at 4 a.m. for his own independent studies, and not trying to study in my time. But he was made very welcome, is ready to bend his back and work. Thank you. You are very welcome. So, Honourable Lavinia.
Thank you, Honourable Member. I was not here. I just want to know what happened to our Lwazi.
Well, you know, we train up people so well, we capacitate them so well, and while we're doing all of that, they're busy applying for other jobs and using me as a reference. But I've been very lucky. I was informed of this about a year ago, and I spoke to the DG of DTI, and I said, and he said, we don't want a coach staff. I said, great, I need him here for at least a year, and because he's not leaving until I get another.
Thank you very much.
Not leaving. I won't have him released. Well, I guess they found someone, they found you. And then they released him to pursue his, an advance in his career. And I think that's great. We can't hold back people, but they must also be responsible about where they are. And not sniff around. That's what they're doing all the time in South Africa. Running from job to job and pushing up salaries. You know, that's why we've got part of the problem is people jumping. Now we've got to put a stop on some of the jumping. They've got to do their stints. Like military service, maybe they ought to do their stints and jumping. Bring in a 3-year term for them. They'll soon know what is done. After they leave school, after university, 3 years government. Then they'll be ready to go and jump and jump. But anyway, that's the, some of the stuff I've been reading in the papers has distressed me while I'm here. Anyway, we're ready to embark now on heavier stuff. I'm very pleased to welcome you back off your heavy political duty, Honourable Lavinia, and also your own studies, in economics. And we've got everyone else on board. I see Honourable Caesar just here, Honourable Kabasa, Line, Honourable Line, Honourable Property, and of course, Honourable Elder. And now we are in a position, although they were here some time ago, to welcome the department and others. We would like to welcome, first of all, I think we need the senior person from DTI. Is that, of course, yourself, Scott? Tony Ferris. Another is right. So I just want to see here. That is, and you're very welcome, Ms. Tony Ferris. Is it Ferris? Ferris. Your position?
She's directing the Capital and Transfer Equipment. She's director for Mental Fabrication, Capital and Transfer Equipment Sector Day.
And welcome to you, Mr. Starkings. We also have here our good friends from the Competition Tribunal. It's just that you need a few more teeth. I mean, you've got the wisdom teeth, but you need those other teeth that grip. Don't release these people. Don't let them walk
So the small farms, as you think. Right. But anyway, it's Mrs. and where it was Mrs. Bob. And this to see, did they throw you in to make sure there was another woman on board? I hope not. Well, I'd like to see your list of people. Any woman are on board. Thank you. Competition Tribunal Researcher. And Mr. Rumble. We've met before on many occasions. And you're doing good work, but just give us that list there from the Competition Commission. And Mr. Insana. That's yourself, right? And Mr. Sylvester. Very profile that was your age. Anyway, we also want to welcome Dr. Jordan. Is that right? Oh, Jordan. There's Jordan, yeah. Well, the independent consultant, when we met at Puka, is that not right? Gave us a true background, filled in the gap, and a few shocks and surprises alongside that. So we were very pleased to, and when we became aware we were dealing with a seal issue, you also gave us some info on that. So you are very welcome. Right, and we're ready at this point to give you 9:30. Let's try 10:15 at this point. You know, half an hour, I think, 9:30 to 10:00. Let's see how you go on your input. See how it goes without cutting corners. And then we'll take questions. If you need a few more minutes, you take a few more minutes. We want a full briefing on the unbundling of ISCO. What is the care background? So that when we go into our interrogation of the child, we will be more adequately briefed and informed. I hope that's clear. So members, now I don't want interruptions. You're economists there, you understand all the basic terms. We don't need any interruptions here, the clarification of anything. So the end. Make your notes. Have we got your notes? The copy. Are you just speaking? No, I've got a presentation. So you're the only one, you see. We can't work like that. We better half an hour to copy it. Can you get someone to copy that? A stick. I have a very good stick. Well, I do. At the Competition Commission. No. You know what?
That's not. We had half an hour to do this. Half an hour. We wasted half an hour. I don't.
You make your notes page by page, slide by slide. Go ahead. Competition Commission got something. Dr. Jordan, liaise with staff, get this copied. We'll go straight into the steel pricing in South Africa, competition history and current concerns. I've already been briefed that
You can't enter into the immediate current issue before you, am I correct? However, you will go up to that point. Right, thank you. So we'll hand over to the Competition Commission. 9:30 to 10:00.
Thank you, Chair.
Start with
our
deck, it'll work from here.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you very much, Chair, honourable members. I'm sorry about the technology, we'll catch up. As the chairperson mentioned, we do have some live cases that were before the competition authorities, and I'm not going to get into too much of detail on those. But I think it's, you know, this is a big, broad, sprawling issue that we're dealing with around the steel markets, and and I'm going to kind of look at this elephant, if you like, from our vantage point and tell you what we see from where we are. I think we go through the history of IFCOR and AMSA, looked at the issue leading up to one of the cases before us, the Harmony Missile case, and look at how the competition authorities decided on this case, look at how the competition board deals with matter of excessive pricing, draw particularly from some of the research done by our chief economist, and then comment briefly on the current. Okay, so very briefly to go through some of the history of IFCOR. IFCOR was established by government in 1927 as a strategic investment. In 1989, it was privatized with significant stakeholding still remaining within the IEC. Between 1996 and 1999, a joint venture between IFCOR and the IEC built the Saldanha steel mill with tax incentives provided by government. And in 2001, there was the unbundling of IFCOR into its iron ore mining. The iron ore mining went to Kumba, and the steel making remained in IFCOR. The understanding at the time that when this was done was that IFCOR was required to ensure the viability and cost competitiveness of local steel production alongside a competitive pricing regime. Between 2001 and 2004, LNM, which is Lakshmi N. Mittal, the name of what became Mittal subsequently, well, what IFCOR became and then subsequently Arsenal Mittal, they were introduced as an international partner in order to improve the efficiency of the firm, to create efficiency improvements, given LNM international experience in steel mining, and it increased its shareholding. In 2004, L&M acquired majority shareholding in IFCOR. This was a matter that came before the competition authorities, and I'll speak a little bit about that later. In March 2006, after very lengthy negotiations with DTI, all of these were occurring within the context of the Competition Commission case, Competition Tribunal case involving Harmony and Mittal. And ArcelorMittal introduced a pricing system, but a new pricing system based on an international basket of prices. I'll speak a little bit about that later as well. And then, bringing us to the current period, we now have a situation where AMSA failed to convert its mineral rights, resulting in a dispute over iron ore prices, and AMSA has implemented a price surcharge to its customers. Just looking now briefly at the L&M acquisition of IFCOR from the previous slide that occurred in about 2004. This was a merger where L&M had less than 50% before the merger and more than 50% of shares after the merger. And in competition law, this amounts to a change of control, and it's therefore notifiable in terms of the Competition Act. But this change of control was a pretty controversial thing in terms of competition law, because it didn't at all change the structure of the market. All it changed was it altered the ownership and the control of this firm. So there wasn't any major competition concerns during this in the course of this acquisition. So it was uncontroversial. It kind of went through the authorities without any fuss at all. But at this time, the DTI was negotiating with L&M, and it concluded a steel pricing agreement with L&M that basically committed L&M to replace the existing import parity pricing, which it had adopted. With a more sustainable developmental pricing model. And the idea here was that would raise the volumes of downstream steel beneficiation in South Africa, and this was important for our exports and the domestic market in compliance with the WTO rules for the South African steel industry. So in addition to this, in the course of this agreement with DTI, in addition to a developmental pricing model, the agreement was that L&M would increase its investment to improve its steelmaking capacities from 6 million tons to 9 million tons. And this included an expansion of the Saldanha steel mill. Just briefly to look at then currently where we stand in terms of the structure of this market, you will see that there's basically two broad categories of products, steel products that are produced: flat steel and long steel. And in both of these products, Mittal is by far the more dominant producer. Its market shares are in excess of 80% in the case of flat steel and 52% in the case of long steel. It's important to note that for a firm to be called dominant in terms of the Competition Act, that firm must have a market share of about 45%. And in both these products, Mittal exceeds that dominance threshold by far. There's just a map showing you where all the steel plants are located in South Africa. Okay, so we've looked at the history briefly of this score. I just want to talk now a little bit about the issues leading up to the Harmony Mittal case. I think the thing to note first and foremost is that I'm going to call it AMSA now, right? So that's ArcelorMittal South Africa. I'm kind of, there's too many names to use. AMSA, ArcelorMittal South Africa, enjoys a monopoly position in this market, and this is due to the fact that it is a former state-owned enterprise and it has continued beyond that period of being a state-owned enterprise to enjoy preferential iron ore pricing, which I think is common knowledge is the price they pay for iron ore is the cost plus 3%. But it's important to note that AMSA's monopoly position was not earned through being a more efficient firm. In the words of Andrew yesterday, this was something that was bestowed upon it by its history. It didn't earn kind of winning market share over time by beating its competitors, as it were. In any event, steelmaking is not the most innovative and dynamic market. It's just producing sheet metal and steel rods. This is not where there's a lot of innovation to create efficiencies and become more competitive through that. Also, this market has significant barriers to entry, which means it's very difficult for a new entrant to come in and establish themselves fresh. And the second point here is that AMSA's pricing is characterized by import parity pricing to its domestic customers and export parity pricing to the customers that export. And these exporters then could have could be paying a price approximately 40% lower than people in the local market, than customers in the local market would pay. This is notwithstanding that South Africa is a net exporter of steel products, and the way in which AMSA is able to pull this off is by getting very firm agreements that its export customers will indeed export the product and not resell it back into the South African market. And these are agreements that it reaches with the exporters that if it's selling at a lower price, that product gets exported and not sold back into the local market. This is a graph that you might be familiar with. It comes from the DTI presentation that was made to this committee earlier this month or so, last month. And essentially what it shows is that the import parity pricing by AMSA has resulted in domestic customers paying far more than what AMSA would be able to receive in its exports. So I think important here is that the nature of this product, the nature of steel products is such that transport costs constitute a large part of the price that is paid in the end. It's bulky, it has to be shipped, it has to be railed. And so all the transport costs constitute a very large part of the final price that's paid. And you'll see that on the left-hand side of this graph, the blue graph shows you the import parity price, and on the right-hand side, the green shows you the export parity price. And the difference between these, and the dotted line in between those two shows you the world export price, and the difference between these two is very significant. It's not an insignificant amount in terms of the percentage of the final amount. And that is the amount that local customers pay over and above what Mittal receives on its exports. I think a nice way of putting this is that the blue line, which is the import parity price, is the price paid against local customers, and this is what AMSA can get away with. This is the price that it can get away with in charging local customers. And the green bar is what it pays exporters, and this represents, in essence, what it is willing to receive. It is willing to receive this green price, but it is able to get away with the blue price, to put it colloquially like that. But this is not just a coincidence, because the exports, the steel sold at the price of the green bar, exports constitute something like 20-30% of the total production of this ore. And so what we end up with is this IPP charge, an import parity price charge, even though IFCO is producing a surplus. for the domestic market. Now, pricing at IPP is not in itself a contradiction of the Competition Act. The issue here is whether or not a competitive market would result in a price lower than IPP. So in a situation where a where this coal might be producing, its production might be less than the domestic demand, what that would mean is that domestic use of steel will be tempted to import this product, and then the price will then stabilize around IPP, around import parity prices. So in situations where local production is less than local demand, it makes sense that the price gravitates towards IPP. But in a situation like we have now, where production, the production capacity of ISCOR is greater than domestic demand, then the prices ought to gravitate more around the export parity pricing rather than the import parity pricing. Okay, so I think the point I made earlier is that this is this graph, which you've probably seen before, it's also from a DGI presentation, where the point here is that exports are not incidental to AMSA's strategy, if you consider the large volumes that are exported, and the fact that AMSA is able to have a pricing regime with separate prices for export sales and domestic sales. Okay, so I'm now going to talk a little bit, the next section, about what the competition authorities did, Competition Tribunal, the Competition Appeal Court, around the Harmony Mittal case. Harmony is a gold mining company, consumer of steel, structural steel that is used for its underground operations, and it was a private complainant against excessive pricing by Mittal. This is a case that went through the system. There was a tribunal hearing and subsequently an appeal court hearing, but it wasn't conclusive in the end because the matter was settled between the parties. Now, for an excessive pricing case in terms of the Competition Act, the first thing that needs to happen is the first point to be made is that excessive pricing, it is only excessive pricing by a dominant firm that is prohibited by the Act. So it's only if a firm is dominant, and the Act defines what dominance is. The Act says that essentially a firm is dominant if it has over 45% market share. So only if, so the first step for an authority like ours to prove excessive pricing is to establish the dominance of the firm that we're dealing with, and that is done in general terms, in terms of the Act, by demonstrating that it's about 45%. But the other important issue here is that excessive pricing occurs in markets where barriers to entry are generally very, very high. This means that these markets are not easily contestable. They can't, you know, it's not easy for a new player to come in and contest the market with the existing incumbents. And so barriers to entry are usually high because of high capital costs and cost advantages from a supply agreement. Now, if you look at the tribunal decision that came out of this case, when it was before the tribunal showed very clearly that Mittal was not just dominant, but a super dominant firm that was uncontested in what was essentially an incontestable market. It also showed that Mittal's ancillary conduct showed how it used its dominance to price excessively in the South African market, and this is because it had the ability to segment the market into domestic and export markets and keep them separate and get different pricing from these two separate markets. Also, it was able to give selective discounts to domestic customers, and it did this whenever customers We found that customers had the ability to import, so it gave them a special deal, a special discount, or if it found that customers were finding another viable alternative to steel, they got also, they were kind of persuaded that they were incentivized to buy steel, continue to use steel by getting special discounts. In any event, in March 2007, the tribunal found that Mittal had contravened Section 8A of the Act by charging excessive price, and this decision was then appealed by Mittal to the Competition Appeal Court. Now, during the tribunal hearing, both parties put forward evidence on the on price comparisons and profitability analysis. So the way the trial was conducted was people, you know, both parties were talking, comparing their prices and how profitable they are, and how profitable AMSA was, and of course, Mittal was making an argument that it was not really profitable. The tribunal, however, didn't use any of these arguments about the profitability. It decided on the grounds that we had a super dominant firm in a uncontested, incontestable market, and that it had the ancillary conduct, which means it could be able to exercise the dominance. It didn't get into the details around, well, you know, what exactly. It didn't start comparing the prices and beginning to calculate what a competitive price would be. Because essentially the tribunals were saying, we don't want to be a price regulator. Once we start deciding what the competitive price is, we would be saying what the price would be, and they were kind of shying away from becoming a price regulator. But they clearly found that there was excessive pricing without kind of quantifying it as well. Now, the Competition Act, how it deals with this is it identifies an excessive price as one which bears no reasonable relation to the economic value. Those are the operative words. An excessive price is one that bears no reasonable relation to the economic value of the good, and which is indeed higher than the economic value. And these were the grounds which led Mittal to appeal the tribunal decision, because it was stuck on the idea around understanding whether its price is indeed not related to the economic value. When the matter then went to the Competition Appeal Court, the Competition Appeal Court outlined its own approach then on how to identify excessive pricing. Its methodology can be kind of summarized as follows. The first thing you need to do is determine the actual price of issue. Then you need to determine what the economic value determine the economic value expressed as an amount of money in quantitative terms, and then you need to compare the actual price with the economic value and make a value judgment regarding the reasonableness or not of the relationship between these two things, the actual price and the economic value. And this value judgment is said needed to be based on whether the charging of an excessive price goes to the detriment of the consumer or not. And so while the Competition Appeal Court set aside the tribunal decision in September 2009, it was not because the facts of that case did not support the tribunal's decision, but rather that there was no effort on the side of the tribunal to assess the credibility of Mittal's defense that it was not earning excessive profits. And this was the point essentially that Mittal took an appeal. So in other words, while the two courts clearly disagreed on the methodology one used in arriving at what is an excessive price, the Competition Appeal Court did agree with the tribunal that on a prima facie basis, one could indeed presume a contravention of Section 8A of the Act. So essentially the Competition Appeal Court said that there's a prima facie case here for excessive pricing, but we don't agree with the methodology that the tribunal used in arriving at its conclusion. Okay, so that's that case. I'm then going to look now, a lot of this comes from work that we've been doing since, on the implications of the test for excessive pricing and what AMSA's likely defense is going to be in this context. A lot of this work comes from work that our chief economist Simon Roberts did in a paper that's been published. Now the way I suppose one goes about determining whether what the relationship is between the price and the economic value, one of the ways is to compare AMSA's prices and costs with those of other countries. Okay? But when you're doing this comparison, what is important is that you look at both the price and the cost, right? And the most useful indicator there is the margin, in other words, the difference between the price and the cost. And of course, in order to be comparing apples with apples, you need to be able to ensure that you're talking about the same quality of steel that you're comparing when you're comparing metals prices with prices in other countries. And if you're doing this, then you will kind of fulfill step two of the Competition Appeal Court methodology. You have a comparative price that you use as the economic value, and we compare metals actual pricing with this comparative price. Of course, there is another way of doing this, which is to compare prices charged in two different markets where one market is more competitive than the other. But just looking at this method for a moment, the comparative pricing, where you're comparing South African prices with prices in other countries, but you're comparing both the price and the cost, what you'll see is that South African prices have, for the most part, been on par with those charged in the high-priced countries such as the US, Canada, and the EU. However, costs in South Africa are likely to be far lower than in these countries and closer to those in the lower-priced countries like China, South Korea, and Taiwan. But even though our costs are lower, our prices don't compare with low-cost countries, rather they compare with high-cost countries. And of course, when you're looking at costs, when you're talking about high costs and low costs, I mean, as a big thing to look at is the input cost, the cost that goes into the production of steel. And we know that the agreement between Kumba was for the agreement between Mittal and Kumba was for iron ore to be on a cost plus 3% basis, that worked out to approximately $35 per ton. But what we also see is that in the recent developments that occurred here, is that clearly Kumba's ability to export is constrained by the capacity of the railway network to transport products, transport coal to the coast. So there's a bottleneck there. There's this, you know, it's not as though if Kumba is not able to sell all its, sell all its coal locally, could automatically export it. There's a bottleneck. There's just that amount of capacity the railways have to move this product to the coast. And so in that context, Kumba's next best option is to get a local buyer. And what we've seen is that in post the dispute between Kumba and AMSA, the current dispute, that the prices that Kumba offered AMSA, that is $50 for Sogama and $80 for Thunderbale and Newcastle, was still considerably less than the export price, which is $147. So in other words, when Kumba is unable to export, it doesn't offer its local customers to export price. It still offers them, it still negotiates with them a price that's considerably lower than the export price. Okay? Of course, the point that you made here is another major input cost advantage to Metal is cheaper electricity input costs in South Africa compared to other countries. Now when one does a cost or price cost analysis with using figures that Simon Dobbins did this analysis using 2004-2005 data, you see that the cost advantages together with a high domestic price result in large profits being earned by ANSA. If you compare domestic price and costs, you find that in that period when there was a gross margin of 45%. That is when the price was $603 and with a cost of $335, and with the expansions that were being undertaken, there was an expectation that the cost would come down even further, resulting in a greater margin that of 54%. And indeed, these expansions did occur. In the 2006 strategy documents of ANSA indicate plans to expand output, and clearly these expansions were justified. The business case for them, in fact, was made on the basis that they would result in cost reduction. In ANSA's 2009 annual report, they stated that they had extended the capacity to 8 million tons, but that the schedule of expansion to 10 million tons has been reviewed in the light of market conditions. And they clearly stated that, however, they remain confident in the long-term growth potential of the region, confident in the long-term growth potential of the region, and the way intent on expanding their capacity further. Now, there is an often made argument, particularly in the context of these competition cases, but elsewhere, that ANSA is not profitable. This is a claim made during the Harmony Mittal case. Mittal used kind of economic consultancy expertise to do a profitability analysis that showed that Mittal was not earning excess profits in economic terms. And the theory behind this was that Mittal was arguing that it had exceptionally high fixed costs based on the valuation of their plants. This resulted in substantial economies of scale, and that, very importantly, the export sales was making a partial contribution to its fixed costs, but not to its profits. That's the argument that they made, concluding that Mittal's dual pricing system is a business imperative. Okay? Now, the practical application of this test by ANSA was raised in the case. It was disputed in our cases, but it was never resolved. And ANSA continues to maintain that its plants are not highly profitable. But let's look at ANSA's profits. Okay, you see here from the data collected by the Competition Commission, quarterly headline earnings of ANSA. And what you'll see here is that, firstly, I mean, there's a kind of obvious thing to look at in quarters 1 and 2 and 3 of 2009. There were losses that needs to be explained, and that's clearly kind of explainable in terms of what was happening at the time. What was happening at the time was ANSA was doing its expansions, while this was happening, in order to keep the mill running, it imported steel to keep the mill running while it was working on its plant. There was, of course, also the recession in the period that would have kind of resulted in some increased demand. But clearly, you'll see that when the plant was back online in from quarter four of 2009 onwards, profits began rising rapidly again, and steadily again at least, and quickly, meaning that, you know, the profitability was back on track. And I think very important here is that it's these expansions, as we pointed out earlier, that were going to, in the longer run, result in lower costs and higher profitability. Also very interesting in this graph, I think, an interesting point to make, is that you'll see significantly higher profits in quarters 1 to 3 of 2008. And it was in this period that AMSA distributed 4 billion rand to its shareholders as special dividends. Okay, very briefly, I'd like to now just make some comments on the current situation. We spoke earlier about AMSA implementing a basket pricing approach in March 2006 based on comparative pricing. This was at the time that it was negotiating with GCI, that was unhappy with IPP, so it then said, okay, we're going to abandon IPP and we'll use this basket pricing approach. And what this basket pricing approach simply is, it's just a simple average. It takes six countries, three of which are high-cost countries, three of which are low-cost countries. It adds and divides by six. It finds a simple average, and that's the price that it sets. Okay? AMSA then also has the ability to manually modify the basket from month to month based on demand and supply. And so that's the new pricing model, well, at least since March 2006. But you know, ultimately for us in the Crop Commission, it's not very clear whether this price, this new pricing model now has resulted in pricing in line with economic factors, whether it will meet our test around whether price is successful or not. And furthermore, I think it's important to say that the facts presented to the DGI by AMSA may not be fully reflective of the actual pricing framework, given that they were, even in the words of the tribunal, prepared to blatantly mislead the tribunal on the implementation of basket pricing for AMSA in the course of the trial. I think the comments on the current surcharge that AMSA has imposed on its customers, that during the dispute at Kumba, it applied a surcharge on top of the basket prices to its customers. And the point to be made here is that the basket, the way it calculated its price based on the basket approach, had already taken into account the cost of iron ore. And now what it's doing, when there's an increase, it's adding that to the price it's charging its customers. So just to put some figures on this, which is not on the slide, right? So the basket calculation assumes that the price of steel is based on $142 price for all. That's what the basket calculation assumes. AMSA used to pay $35, right? Well, plus or minus, $35 at this cost plus 10%. So even though the pricing was the comparative pricing was, the assumption there was 142, it used to pay 35. Now that the price has moved from 35 to 80, which is still less than the 142, it's adding the difference of 35 to the difference between 35 and 80 to the price that it charges its customers. Yeah? Okay. So, I think that we've been looking at this matter because of a complaint made to us even before this kind of current crisis became got into the news in the way that it did. And I should say that the theory in excessive pricing required for the firm charging excessive price for a long period of time for us to do any meaningful analysis to look at its effects. And this surcharge was only imposed for a few months, so it's hard to kind of look at the economic effects of this in that short period of time. But certainly, the ability to unilaterally impose a surcharge on goods does give us a good insight into the degree of AMSA's dominance and the power it has in these markets. Finally, without going into too much detail, I should just say that the competition authorities do currently have a number of steel cases that is dealing with some involving Mittal and others not involving Mittal. Some of these cases have to do with abusive conduct, which is those of a predominant firm, and others have to do with cartel-based behavior where competitors are fixing prices amongst themselves. These are significantly in tin plate, which was something that was referred to us by the current Minister of Trade and Industry when he was still the Deputy Minister. And then in the cartel side, we have a long steel case against Mittal and Heisel, and a number of cases dealing with reinforcing steel bar and wire products coming out of steel. Thank you very much.
Mr. Rumbel, the Commissioner of the Competition Commission, thank you. That was a very, very informed yet concise input. Thank you. And certainly, looking at members, I think it certainly assisted them with a lot of clarification in this regard. So it will be over to the members now to raise any questions in this regard. Regard to the presentation that has just been made, I want to remind members we cannot deal with the current dispute because it is already, with us, we are undertaking the inquiry, and that while it is not, I understand right now, before yourself, it could well land up. And that would compromise your position in that regard. So we don't want the competition authority's position to be compromised. But there are many, many other issues, principal issues, that remain as applicable in this regard. So please raise your hand. If you wish to clarify or if you wish to raise a question. Yes, we'll be taking a few. That's the Honourable Harris, Honourable September, Honourable Kadebi, Honourable Kotsi, Honourable Kobata. That's fine. Of course, if there is someone who just wants to raise a hand, they can do that now. Otherwise, let's have the first group of questions.
Thanks, Chair. Because I'm relatively new to this, some of my questions might be better answered by DTI, I imagine. So, I'm happy to come. Just to pass the ball on that. There's no page number, but I think it's the sixth slide, which is about the market structure. Just for information, do the other producers, as small as they may be, do they simply just match the price of AMSA? Is there any competition there at all, or do they just take the price of the dominant place? Then under the list of issues, perhaps this is more a DTI issue, but I understand the significant barriers to entry in the market, but are there things that the state could be doing to lower some of those barriers? And then the very useful graph showing the distinction between the export price and the import parity price, Where does the new basket pricing fit on the scale? What is? I don't think you specified what the average basket pricing came out at, and I'd be interested to see where it fits on that scale between those two prices. With regard to the initial case, which was overturned, does the finding by the Competition Commission include an action set, what should be done, recourse that should be taken, and what was on the table at that point? What was the proposal to tackle this excessive pricing initially? Are you going to stop me there, Chair?
Well, I think, look, for the moment, we can come back. Thank you. Honourable September.
Chair, thank you very much. And I trust you got my apologies for coming back.
Very good.
Thank you, ma'am.
Well, thank you very much for returning to the committee after your medical visit.
You're most welcome, ma'am. And thank you very much for the presentation. I agree with you, Chair. There's quite a number of things that have been said to us. I want to zoom into one or two things around the price issue again that I have been raising consistently. Our resolve, Chair, or where we would seek comfort or remedy from would be in the relevant legislation. That we have responsibility for in this committee. Now, in listening to part of the presentation, and particularly the sections where you spoke about dominance, I want to submit, Chair, the first thing is that dominance is not just the one example that you gave. South Africa, our economy in South Africa is extremely characterized by a dominant firm, and in particular, many of them that have prohibitive barriers. So that's the first problem that we have. The second one, which I think you have raised already, is that, which probably brings me back to the Act again. The Act says that they must ensure that the activities do not fall within the type of conduct considered to be abusive or dominant. Now, it's very nice to unpack that, Chair, and really find out what exactly did we mean there when the Act was put together. And I'll tell you why, Chair, because when you raise the issue of economic value and of reasonable relations, I think that's where our problem is, because what is meant by economic value and what is meant by reasonable relation, and particularly between price and economic value, now that is where it's not clear. It's not clear in the Act, neither is it clear in South Africa's jurisprudence. Now, if that is the case, then the learned friends are concurring with each other. If that is the case, then, Chair, I would ask that it is the responsibility of this committee to zoom into that aspect. Because you can have Kumba, you can have everything else, but if sufficient guidance is not given around our legislation and our law in general in South Africa that we need to seek comfort from, when these problems arise, then we need to unpack that. So I want to ask, Chair, we should maybe, as a committee, delve a little bit deeper into an analysis of excessive price. In the US, they don't have any regulation, but in the EU and South Africa, we have this thing it's considered abuse of dominance. But it doesn't spell it out very clearly what exactly it is that we need to do. So, of course, the Competition Commission, I could hear, is then caught up within this unclear or not. And I think it's our responsibility then to rescue a competition commission in this regard also, because if they are our vehicle to assist in this, then our vehicle must be capacitated sufficiently to give guidance. You can talk about all these other types of stuff. So, Chair, that's what I want to submit that we need to do, because in any event, the only thing that dominant firms do is they rely on demand and supply. And here, even in this instance, demand and supply for them doesn't mean that they will always stay safe from the Competition Act. So, Chair, that's my submission. I thank you.
Right, thank you, Honourable September. We now have Honourable Sadebe.
Thank you, Chairperson. First of all, I also appreciate the input made by the Competition Commission. But what is critical here is the issue of the looting of the South African resources. Really, the status quo cannot be maintained. You cannot have a situation whereby the resources of the country, which belongs to all these people, are made to benefit people outside the country. I think that principle is wrong. It can be the import parity price, which is wrong. Number two can be the basket price. Because I don't understand why do we have to do what is happening in the EU and in America when our structure of electricity is not the same, when their natural product is not the same. Why does this natural product benefit the local people in South Africa? Number two, again, I think the presentation confirms the fact that the asylometer is still in breach of the family and banding principles which were undertaken before. That when they were given the cost plus 3% price, it was they were supposed to have passed that to the local economy. Instead, they did the vice versa. I think that something must be done around that. Because if it was a gentleman's agreement, it was wrong, but if it is black and white, they must be pursued with vigor. In fact, they must be sued, and they even go to the extent that they must be sued for breaching a contract which they understood before. Because really, if you can look at the rate of unemployment, Chairperson, even at the zenith of this growth of our economy, unemployment remains at more than 23%. We cannot allow that situation to persist as the parliament of the people. I think that those people must be pursued with a vigor and with all the power we have in our assailants. And then number three, we also go to the issue of the Competition Committee or the Competition Appeal Court. I think that they set aside the decision of the tribunal last year in September. Right now, we are only 2 weeks away from September. It's almost a year down the line. The special class has already been introduced. What is the turnaround time for the CAC to conclude this matter? Because we cannot allow this thing to be in perpetuity when the economy of the country is bleeding. What is because the funding principle of our government is back to being. If there's anything which harms the people, it must be kept as quickly as possible. So now we're almost 11 months down the line. What is it? This has been done. And then on the other issue, the Competition Commission is that I know that in terms of dealing with the annual turnover when we impose penalties, we have to check the law that will give you the power so that you can even disintegrate companies which are doing this thing to happen. If you don't have that, tell us so that we can do something about that.
Thank you very much. Honourable Kotsi?
Chair, I'm not sure. I don't know why every time it's today we don't have water, but we take my tender. I'll be facing it. Thanks. Chair, my issues are related to what Honorable Fadele is saying. I see here that AMSA enjoys monopoly position due to it being a former SOE, which means the preferential iron ore pricing is cost plus 3. If at this point in time, after so many years, we are not able to create the kind of employment and that benefit or that we gave, South Africa gave to ArcelorMittal, why are we continuing with that? If that is making South Africans suffer, why are we still sticking to the cost plus 3? I think we need to go to the drawing board and reconsider that, because it's not helping South Africans, this benefit that they are being given. It's actually benefiting other people, as Comrade Becky is saying. On the same page of four, we say issues. It says, this was maintained through agreements with exporters not to refer their products back to South Africa. And at the moment, that is not happening. Those agreements, how are they working? If there was such agreements, and when they return to South Africa, these exporters, it is not actually there. They are returning, and it is not, again, at the benefit of South Africa. Again, in terms of the competition, the whole thing of the basket that the presenter gave us, which is not on the fact that the basket calculation, that there was $142, and then even when they were paying $35 and so forth, still, even with that South Africans still suffer. You know, the basis here is that whatever they get, whether they can sell their products abroad, that is not, in terms of South Africa, we still suffer in our companies. Hence, we are not able to move. My main issue here, Chair, is that cost plus three, why is it still applying? If after all this, is actually not benefiting, because they are sticking to that, they've got an advantage in terms of the ordinary people who they have to deliver to locally. Why are we still sticking? Perhaps if the TI could answer that and what they are doing about that, and other matters.
Thank you very much. I'm Honorable Barker. This technology does not exist in Agiti and Makaya, just to say. Yeah, thank you, Chairperson. Just in terms of the Competitions Act, when you say that ArcelorMittal introduced a new pricing system based on international pricing, what is legally acting within its rights then? And what was the cost in job terms? And secondly, Chairperson, I'd like to know if AMSA, by introducing excessive pricing for domestic markets, was it passing on its cost of production that it probably would have lost through cheaper prices? Through cheaper export prices. And what are the implications thereof?
Right. We will hold, as you know, a second bank after this has been responded to. We usually take five at a time. So it's over to the Competition Commission. And obviously, the Commissioner will. I'm sure distribute some questions.
Thank you, Chair. I'm going to attempt to answer all questions and then I'll ask my colleagues to add if there's any additional points. On the question of whether the remain in... Okay, firstly, the question around market structure was whether the non-dominant players just match the price of the dominant player, whether they compete with each other. I think there, you know, in the case of an 80% market share and one other player, that question doesn't perhaps apply so clearly. But in the other case, I should just say that we've also investigated producers' behavior in this industry. There's a very complicated system around how these exports occur to steel merchants as the intermediaries, the short answer is that if your question is about whether there is some competitive constraint on Mittal by the existence of these other players who might be competing with each other, the answer is no. There isn't that competitive constraint on them. The question around there's been a number of questions around basket pricing and the basket price. I think the important thing to be said here is that, sure, the methodology for determining these prices from using an IPP method and a basket methodology of comparator prices, the methodology changed. But we don't see any evidence of the prices having substantively or meaningfully changed. It's just the methodology that seems to have changed. There doesn't seem to be any difference. You know, you can't say that once the methodology changed, there was a significant decrease in price. It just pretty much ended up being the same kind of price or at the same level. That's a very kind of broad answer. I think that kind of that could be answered in more precise quantitative terms, which I'm not able to do here, but one can kind of work the numbers around that. What was the Competition Tribunal's remedy, essentially, was the next question, after having found that that Mittal was dominant? How did one cure the problem? And essentially, what the Competition Tribunal's remedy was to remember we said that what was happening is that there were different prices charged to local producers and exporters were not allowed to resell back into the local market, right? And what the tribunal said is that that practice needs to be stopped, that there must be no it mustn't be imposed upon any particular group of people to not sell back into the market. So you can imagine that they would stop price discrimination under those circumstances if they didn't kind of impose that. And that would prevent then Mittal from segmenting the market into local and exporters and kind of demanding on exporters that they don't resell back into the local market. So this all has to do with the arbitrage issue and how that kind of managed. Comrade September's points are well taken. I don't have many comments on that. I mean, I think that is very kind of insightful and precise, that is the problem we have. You know, you're going to work out economic value. There's a value judgment there. One person's value judgment is not the same as the other. It would be kind of useful to have legislative guidance around this. But I think more importantly, some of these debates needs to be also be won in the discipline of economics. You know, academics need to be fighting this out and kind of working out the best way in which one kind of calculates these things. And I think you'd be very right about the kind of differences between the European and the United States approaches to this. In the United States, the issue of excessive pricing doesn't carry much currency. Put it bluntly, people in the United States don't believe in this concept of excessive pricing, whereas in Europe, it's a more kind of widely held concept, and it's something that I think is more applicable to our context than the U.S. approach. The Honorable Khadede's comments are well taken. I think, there is a problem around kind of a local resource not being used optimally for the benefit of local people. Clearly the quid pro quo, if you like, of the iron ore at cost plus 3% was that there would be developmental pricing and there would be an increase in capacity, and it seems like that hasn't happened. That is outside the one misunderstanding, though, is that this Competition Appeal Court case, what happened here is that, remember, this is GoTo again, the tribunal took a decision finding that there was excessive pricing. It went on appeal to the Competition Appeal Court. The Competition Appeal Court said, look, on the face of first prima facie, it looks like it's excessive pricing, but you applied the wrong legal test in coming to that conclusion. We're sending it back to the tribunal, and this is the test that the tribunal must now apply, kind of laid it out. It went back to the tribunal, but when it got to the tribunal, the two parties concerned, the complainant and Mittal, settled the matter between themselves, and the case didn't proceed any further. Okay, so we did kind of reach ultimate conclusion on that case. Harmony was, you know, was a firm that was kind of smaller firm and kind of, you know, fought the battle for as long as they could and didn't have the resources to kind of proceed any further. You know, I've kind of answered the question around the cost of 3% and the SOD support. I think I've answered those questions. And then I think I've answered most questions, but if you would like to say something.
Perhaps I should just say that the barriers to entry for other players into this market is so high because of that cost of 3% price of iron ore that ArcelorMittal pays. Other players won't get iron ore that cheaply, and therefore won't be able to compete in the final price.
I'd like to think I have addressed all questions, but if I haven't, I'll be reminded.
Perhaps DCI wishes just to comment. Do you wish to comment, Mr. Stockton?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think it might be a good idea just to send our previous presentations to the Honourable Harris, which explains in some detail the question that he's asked. One of the points, obviously, is that the unbundling process was a commercial agreement between two companies, which we can be critical of, but it left the state with limited levers. I think to answer the question concretely, there have been efforts to bring in another producer. That either has to be a very large global player who can compete at the level of economies of scale, or a small niche mill of some kind or another. I think it's a matter of public record that those efforts have been largely unsuccessful, partly or because of a range of reasons. One is securing cheap iron ore. Secondly, concessional industrial financing, and as you know, this is a critical transversal intervention suggested by the IPAC, which we are working on, and one of the benefits of securing concessional industrial financing would be to enable the state to leverage this funding in critical strategic sectors, including the creation of competition for this particular sector. But perhaps we can provide a detailed briefing to the Honourable Harris, and I'm not sure whether my colleague at Tandy would like to add.
I think to add on what Mark Lita has already spoken about, I think one of the things that we have also been looking into, in the past, we're trying to move away from traditional technologies such as gas analysis, which requires large economies of scale in order for the mills to be very viable in the long term. So we're doing work with the IDC around promotion of minerals where the technology is easier to deploy in minerals, you know, rather than an integrated steel plant that requires significant amounts of iron ore and requires at least as you know, your output has to be at a certain level in order for the steel that the plant to be to be viable. We're working with the IDC on this. We've been working with the IDC for the past 2 to 3 years. And I mean, to add on like mentioned from the Competition Commission itself, the cost of 50% arrangements in the past has always made it very difficult for a new player to come and compete on an equal basis because the market forces were not equal for a new player who's going to come when the cost of iron ore was so relatively lower for Mika. And I think also to add on the response from the commission around the basket pricing, in our submission in about 3 weeks ago to the portfolio committee where we made a presentation around this, we indicated that the basket price really has not made any significant movement on what used to be a predicated ITP in the past to this new type that we're talking about. And I mean, even in Middle and Aggression, in their submission about a month ago, also into this committee, they acknowledged that, one, they have not always really followed this basket pricing. So the basket pricing is there in principle, but they have not really been doing it consistently. And I mean, it's more evident in 2009 and 2010 prices, which they said that actually they moved away in order to, you know, cushion against the economy crisis. And, you know, they made arguments about they had the option of, you know, cutting jobs or retaining a price at a higher level in order to make the plant profitable or, you know, to break even in certain areas. Thanks.
Trevor? I just wanted to check what members, if they felt the question had been responded to, Honourable Kubasa, Honourable Bailey, after that, Honourable Cost-Reading, but just
yeah, Chakakuma, I didn't hear the response to the question with regard to ArcelorMittal acting within legal limits, not with it, by introducing the unified system, notwithstanding the initial agreement between the CPI and the company to price iron ore steel such that it contributes to the whole question of beneficiation and job creation. And that's why I raised the question, what were the implications of that? What were the costs in job care? I didn't hear the answer to that question. Secondly, I didn't hear the answer with regards to the passing on of the cost of production to the domestic market through the ICT.
Dr. Bailey?
Just as in, what didn't come from, this must come from the CCI, and why is the ArcelorMittal not being sued for breaking the agreement, the original agreement? Yeah. That of passing the ArcelorMittal price to the first half of Congress tomorrow. Number two would be the issue of the Competition Commission. On the issue of the maximum penalty, are they satisfied with the current one where they are only using the annual turnover? Must change the law so that we can come with a stronger measure to deal with this issue, even go to a set of monthly monopoly companies with NESA.
The issue of some of the agreements reached at the time that exporters will not resell their products back to South Africa. You know, if that is happening and what is being done about that, I don't want to answer that. Because according to this, that was one of the initial agreements of all these benefits that they were given after the meeting.
We will take the second bank in a minute over to both DCI and Competition Commission.
When the honourable member refers to the agreement between the DTI, just bear in mind, I think, the remarks that I made previously, that the original unbundling involved a commercial arrangement between two companies, and our efforts to secure lower prices was not legally enforceable. And the reality of what has happened is that it's been shown that these two private companies, at the end of the day, do their own thing. As you know, Honourable Member, the Ministers of Mineral Resources, Trade and Industry and Economic Development have a task team now headed by the DGs of all three departments, which is looking at the original agreement, looking at the Minerals Act, the Competition Act, and other instruments that could be brought to bear and be legally enforceable. That committee is due to report to the minister shortly, and I'm sure will come back to this committee with its recommendations. But to answer the question, the negotiations and discussions between the DTI and ArcelorMittal, because of the original unbundling agreement, which was located in a commercial arrangement between two companies, isn't legally enforceable. And that's what we have to look at. What legally enforceable measures can we bring to bear to ensure that we get a developmental steel price, which is central to the rolling out of the Industrial Policy Action Plan?
Ralph, we're moving on to the commission now.
There are a lot of questions with the DGR, but the two that were to us, I think around whether we're passing the cost on the cost of production to the domestic market. I think that's an important insight, because what that is, you know, one way of looking at this is that what is effectively happening here is that domestic customers are subsidizing our international customers. And if that's the point you're making, I think that's a very important insight of what's going on here. On the question of whether our penalties are high enough, this is a matter of ongoing debate. I mean, if you read the newspaper 2 days ago, a lot of lawyers are saying our fines are too high and they're going to put companies out of business, and when companies go out of business, we'll have less competition, so we're going to be counterproductive in promoting competition if our fines are too high and they put companies out of business, which is a fair argument in theory, but I don't think that has ever happened in our experience or will in the foreseeable future in practice. I think that we, I think that it's something that we need to continuously keep our eye on. In other words, are the penalties and the fines of the competition authority a sufficient deterrent for this practice to occur? I think that's the question that we should continuously be asking and be mindful of. I don't want to kind of declare at this point that we need substantially higher fines. We already have, we just recently went through that process in Parliament.
Of
the production and penalty.
We'll just take our last basic question, and this is not an opportunity to bring in preambles. Yes, so we have yourself, Mr. Could you pronounce your own name for me, sir? Mr. Honourable Smoller. And then we have Honourable Indikalana was there. Yours was a follow-up. You won't be doing so. You should have come with the last block. Did you?
Yeah, mine was a question I wanted to ask, and you stopped me because I couldn't find it online.
Right, that's the danger of coming in first. Right. Honourable Indikalana, Honourable Elvis, Honourable Harris.
Thank you, sir. You refer to in that slide with the graphics where Mittal actually showed a loss in the second and third quarter in 2009.
I just want to confirm something. Looking at the agreement that was actually signed, was there actually a sort of transgression in that in that actual agreement? And how does that actually impact the situation? And secondly, would be and at the CSC decision. That there was no effort to assess the credibility of the defence that was made by Mitchell and the access to those profits. I just want to understand why was that not, you know, the understanding of why was that not done, and also coming back to making the playing field level. Maybe this would be answered by DTI. Is the supplying of energy to the various people on the fields of the various mines, so called, East Coast or Mitchell is already getting an energy reduced price, and the other competitors. Not at the same level. Is there a time frame or that will bring these competitors together at some point?
Right, Honourable Ticolona.
Thanks, now that you've preempted the unique preamble, I'll go right into the question, but I will give us a couple of minutes down the line. Can mind still around the argument of exporters, understanding that there's been some reference in your response to it, but my curiosity is that how legal is that vis-a-vis the general notion of free market or allowed market scenario? How does someone say, I am trading with you, but you will not bring just the very product or downstream product thereof back to this market, but at the same time, we as the players in the industry or in the economy are supposed to be advising, you know, the terms of free market. You know, how or is it a matter of ethical conduct, or there be any regard or of it? Yeah. But this is what is tracking me. The second question is that, if you remember the last term, we've been reduced to DCI a couple of measures that transit competition commission. Now my question is, in your view, I'm looking at the ability of the community foundation to handle such complex cases of uncompetitive behavior. Would you say that those extra powers that you've given the authorities and the number of other instruments that you've got, are they adequate, or is it still falling short in addressing such kind of things? The one I just raised, but also what also comes back into mind is also the harmony case, because as you say, you know, it generally seems to have been okay to follow up the key, but now the very applicant came to an arrangement with the respondent, and then the case died. But still, the issue is still at hand because it died. There's still an uncompetitive key, but that's number. The last one said, I hope also the child would help in responding to this one. Previously, AMSA, in some of its responses, claimed unfair competition in international markets. How valid is that? Or definitely, how true is that? Because, I mean, obviously, or honestly, one takes anything from AMSA with a pinch of salt. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And then we have a minute on the Albert.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just some three questions. The first one regarding this agreement of the DTI and LRM. It seems that the with the unbundling process, these the lawyers that advised them were quite clever for them to make sure that there's no assignment of the obligations of the agreement. And I would like to come to a better understanding how LNM and later on the AMSA actually got out of the obligations of the agreement with the DTI to beneficiate downstream. Secondly, on the instrument itself, I would like to ask the Commission whether they have the idea what would have been the logical outcome of the CAC's decision had it gone ahead, and if there's anything to learn by that, and also whether they have any lessons or any points regarding amendments to the existing instrument that would empower South Africans and that would provide us with the policy outcomes that we want in terms of beneficiating South Africans as well within the framework of our international obligations, obviously. And coming to international obligations, just the contract not to resell back into South Africa. I'm not sure, but do you have any opinion, legal opinion, whether that would be contrary to our own international obligations, whether there would be any remedies in there to force AMSA to actually release their counterparts on those obligations. Thank you.
Thank you. Honourable Helen.
Thanks, Chair. Chair, I've just taken a quick look at the Competition Act. I don't know it well, so excuse me if I get it wrong. But it seems that the point that the decision that the tribunal came to around the excessive pricing is very much contravened Section 8A. And it seems, obviously, the allegation is that they got up on a technicality, and I have sympathy with that position. But did the tribunal decision deal with the two other issues, which are, to my mind, the agreement with the exporters not to re-import and the cost of 3% agreement, or are those two issues kind of ring-fenced by the fact that they negotiate or agreements between two private companies? But the point is, out of these three issues, the excessive price and the agreement to export is not to re-import and the cost of 3%, we have serious questions raised around competitiveness in our economy. And is there a way we can enforce the Competition Act more efficiently without necessarily going through the tribunal process and then allowing the appeal court to overturn it on a technicality? It may be overly simplistic, but we effectively have a breach of one of our laws that we're unable to deal with and tackle. Is there a way we could do this whole thing more efficiently without allowing the lawyers to overturn it? Thank you.
Right. It's over to yourselves now.
Thank you, Chair. In the first question, there was the reference made to the agreement sign. I understand that to be the agreement with DTI, smaller. I'll try to answer that in a legal way as well. We'll pass that one on to the DTI. There's a question about whether seeking clarity on the CAC's point that there was no effort to assess the credibility of Mitchell's defense about its profitability. I'm going to repeat some of what I said, but here, essentially, there is a disagreement between the tribunal and the CAC on how to apply the excessive pricing provisions in the Competition Act, how to give it meaning, how to take the decision around whether something is excessive, a price is excessive or not. the tribunal says that, look, if you find that a firm is super dominant in an uncontested, incontestable market and can have ancillary behavior to exercise its power in the market, that's enough for us to say the firm's dominant. The CAC says, look, you need to actually do the price calculation. You need to work out what their cost and price is now. You need to work out what the economic value of the of the product is. You've got to compare the two and say whether, you know, the actual price is above the economic value. So they're talking about a more quantitative approach in making this call. And one of the reasons they gave for having this quantitative approach is they say that if you take that approach, you would be able to assess Mittal's claim that they're not profitable. You'd be able to say something about that, whereas in the tribunal approach, you can't address the Mittal's counter claim about its profitability. And I think that's the point that's being made there. I hope that's clear, right? There's a lot of questions about how the ability of Mittal to essentially segment the market. It has people who are buying for local consumption and people who are buying for export. And its ability to say to the people who are buying for export, look, if you buy this for me, you will export it. You will not resell it back into the local market because I'm giving you a lower price. I'm charging the local guys higher. I'm giving you a lower price, but I'll only give you that lower price if you indeed export this product, right? Now, whether it's legal or not, I think it's a kind of contractual issue. It's a contract between two people. I'll sell you this on condition your further behavior is this, right? But I think it does indicate the power of Mittal to be able to negotiate such a contract. Why would I, as the buyer, agree to it? You know, I would agree to it, okay, give me this and I'll sell it, I'll only export it. I would agree to that because I know that I don't have a choice, because the person selling it to me is a dominant player with extreme power. If I don't buy from him, there's nobody else to buy from, essentially. So I think that's what it demonstrates here. It demonstrates the kind of sheer brute power of a firm to be able to conclude such an agreement, to extract such an agreement from the person he's selling to. And I think that kind of answers a number of the questions asked. Related to that is, I think interestingly, this is precisely what the remedy of the Competition Tribunal was when it decided this case. Competition Tribunal said its remedy was Mittal shall not do that again. It shall not impose to its customers who they can and cannot sell to. In effect, that's what the tribunal's remedy was. And the tribunal said that's the thing that will solve the problem. The prices will all coalesce to one price. Mittal no longer has the ability to segment the market. And that was the kind of logic of their thinking. There's been questions around Gisela's question about whether any of the previous amendments would assist us in this particular case. If you're asking about this particular case, none of them are particularly relevant to this case. I think that, you know, that's not something we can I can apply to in this particular case. But you also asked questions that I've answered about the contract around that. The question around agreement with the GCI is not something I'm altogether familiar with the detail of, but I'm going to leave that over. There was a question about if we continued along the path that the CAC set around analyzing, around using its methodology, and whether, and I've been asked to say what I think the outcome would be. I think we have begun thinking about that methodology. Some of the work, like some of the paper I spoke about Professor Roberts having put out the published academically deals and some of that. I think that although, even though the kind of test that the CAC put out is a very complex test, it requires a data-intensive test, it requires a lot of crunching of information and data, and in the end it requires a judgment call around the, you know, economic value versus the price. Comrade Pretender's point here around the difficulty around that. So there are difficulties with how one applies that. But I feel, you know, in as much as the Competition Commission knows about it, fairly confident that that's a test that would have been passed. In other words, that we would have, in applying all of that, concluded exactly the same thing that the tribunal did, that there was indeed a dominant firm operating here. Yeah, and I have answered the question around contracts to resell and whether they are legal or not. I mean, I think those are private contracts. People, the free market, I'm afraid people are also entitled to have private agreements with each other, and that's how it turned out. But as I pointed out, this was an agreement not between equal parties, because Mittal had the power to impose this will.
Thank you, BTR.
Thank you, Chairperson. In response to the annual knowledge, I think I pronounced that correctly, question. The energy agreement presented by this company was an energy, and so. Energy agreements are done by ESCOM and the Department of Energy with their clients, so I'm not going to be able to speak on the detail of your question in that regard, but what we can say, which we demonstrated when we did a presentation to this committee about a month ago, is that the AMSA is in the lowest quartile of costs globally. If you take into account the cost of energy, the cost of iron ore, the cost of reductants, in other words, coal, and transport costs. But it is in the highest quartile globally of prices. Now, the way I think to try and understand that perhaps a little bit better is to look at the Korean steel manufacturer, producer, POSCO, which has the highest cost in the world. It imports all its iron ore, it imports its reductants for coal, it has high electricity, but it's in the lowest price quartile globally, which we demonstrated. And so, from a GTI's perspective, clearly there is a significant problem, and as we showed in some detail, unless we solve that problem, given the centrality of steel for all the downstream manufacturing industries, we have a problem. Again, I'm faced with perhaps dealing with what we dealt with in the past in response to Member Honourable Albert's question. I think at the time the Honourable Turok made a comment which is the headline the next day in the newspaper that we should call the people who've been responsible for some of those arrangements, that you should call them to this committee. It includes the IEC, which was played quite a central role in the agreements with LNM and so on and so forth. I mean, if the Honourable Member wants it, we would provide a written report on those negotiations, which we had to factor in, of course, took place in a different time when there were considerable other differences in the global market that we can do them.
More words from the Competition Commission.
Chair, I failed to answer one question, and Yongano would like to make a point. The last question was about whether there's a more efficient way of dealing with these matters rather than these kind of drawn-out technical legal way of operating. And that's a fair question and a good question, considering if anybody's following in the last 2 days in the newspaper, we have lost a case at the Supreme Court of Appeal against that we've been working on for 3-4 years against the milk cartel on a technical legal point. And I think it would be useful to kind of read that judgment and see how the courts think about us and how we operate. I think that there's two things here. One is that, you know, the legal nature of our proceedings, I'm convinced it is necessary given the constitutional state in which we operate. The Constitution demands that certain things be done in particular ways. I think that we must make every effort, I think it's right, to kind of work within those boundaries and work, you know, it requires a certain fairness and procedure around it. The problem with that, though, is that not everybody has equal access to playing this game, because you need lawyers, you need, you know, you need to be well-resourced to do so, not, you know, so while in theory, all right, in practice, people with deeper pockets end up having more rights than people with not so deep pockets. And I think that's a bigger problem than just competition law. That's a problem with law more generally. So that question applies all over, not only to us. So a lot of whether this continues to happen also depends on the attitude of respondents to this law. If respondents feel, hey, you know, let's kind of get clever lawyers to kind of work around the system and avert it, and that's their strategy, which sometimes is a very worthwhile strategy with respect to competition law, because while you're keeping a judgment, while you're delaying a judgment from happening, if you can delay it for 2-3 years, in that 2-3-4 years, you continue reaping these monopoly and cartel profits. So it could be worth your while when you do the math, you know. And I think that a broader kind of culture change among South African business to kind of play the game in a fairer way with regulators is also something that a forum like this can kind of assist with and impose on more generally. But Yolanda would like to say something.
No, mine is just to respond to a comment by Angela. Mine is just to respond to a comment by Honorable Chikalana on an argument around the competition in the international market that has been raised by Amber. It's just to note two things. One being that, I mean, I think it's an argument that hasn't come through to us in all the cases we've dealt with that involved in Mittal. But just two things to note. One being that Mittal is the second largest steel producer in the world, and their position in the world market certainly gives them influence in terms of competition dynamics, so they can't raise arguments like that. The other thing being that if you notice a low export price, it certainly is indicative of much better competition dynamics in the international market than what we are seeing in the local market, so those aren't arguments that they should be raising.
Members, I'd like to, on your behalf, to thank the Competition Commission, Competition Tribunal, for availing themselves and making themselves accessible to us this morning. We would also like to request that you remain here for the duration, which, although we were scheduled to end at 12:30, you know we only started at 9:30, so we will be finishing at 1300. So we would appreciate that. Right now, members, it is 12:20. If we do want to finish at 13, 20 past 11, if we want to finish at
quarter at 1300 and not 1330. Please be back in 10 minutes, 11:30.
Sure.
And the minimum
minerals for development and causes are comprehensively priced field by Dr. Paul Jordan, Integrated Development Consultant, Cape Town. Right, so he's giving it to the Portfolio Committee for Trade and Industry. Everyone got one? Great. Now, it's over to yourself, Dr. Paul Jordan. Just to let you know how much time you've got, we're looking at a situation from 12:30, okay, I mean 11:30, I don't know why I keep on thinking 12:30, 11:30 to 12:15, okay, so 12:00, we can try and finish as close as possible to about 12:10 to 12:10 to enable us to ask some questions. Thank you. Over to you.
Thank you very much, Chair. First of all, looking at the thickness of the handout, there were lots of hidden slides, in fact, half the slides, and unfortunately when it was printed out, it printed out all the slides, but I'm only going to give you the ones that weren't hidden. Just some background. First of all, as opposed to the discussion we've had, the position of this presentation follows much more the Honourable Kadede's position, and that is that this is a national resource, and we need our natural comparative advantages to flow through to the final fabricated products. I mean, those differential rents, those extra rents, because we have the resource in particular grades, should not all be taken by the upstream dirt diggers or the intermediate product producers. That we need it to flow down to where the jobs are, basically. And being a national asset, of course, we can do that if we're clever. The second is that developmental states, or what are sometimes called command economies, including the Tigers, to some extent the Nordics, etc., such as South Korea, Taiwan, and China, all ensure that critical feedstocks for industrialization, meaning manufacturing, were made available at competitive prices through various forms of state intervention, sometimes outright control. They understood the importance of having those feedstocks at competitive prices. Then finally, a little bit of history. We came out of 100 years of import substitution industrialization, where you produced for the local modest market behind high barriers. That was until our gas offer in 1993. At that point, we changed to opening up our economy and international competitiveness. Now, monopoly pricing was part of that strategy. From the end of the 19th century through to the 1990s, for 100 years, that monopoly, that was the tariff the government gave. That if you set up Colombia, you can charge this import parity price. And not only that, we'll slap on a big tariff so the import parity price will become even bigger. The national sport was not rugby. It was monopoly pricing. It's been here. I remember the head of AMIC saying, "What's your problem?" when we were complaining about hyper. This was old Leslie Boyd saying, "You charge what the market will bear, i.e., you screw them for what you can get them for." You know, it's my experience. You raise the price to their alternative. Their alternative is import. So what's the cost in Shanghai? What's the cost of getting it here? What's the cost of tariffs and transshipment? What's the cost of readiness? And we charge the poor fellow across the fence the Shanghai cost up all those costs, which was in that price bill that we saw. So this was a mistake we made as a new government. You don't just open up your economy. You've actually got to deal with these inherent bad cost practices from an earlier model, a model that worked to some extent in the 60s. In 1996, I was advisor to the then Minister of Trade and Industry, a fellow called Trevor Manuel at the time, before he went to finance. And I did a memo on import parity pricing. And most people in DDI didn't know what the hell I was talking about. Then we've got to deal with it. The main feedstocks into our manufacturing, polymers, monopoly price. Steel, monopoly price. We don't stand a chance if we want to really become an exporter. In addition, at that time, Derek Keyes, the minister before, in finance, had put on the incentives for the plants that they would competitively price under the 37E. And what these fellows did, Gencor now BHTB, and ISCOR now Mittal, they said, these plants, Hillside, Saldana, only for export. So although there was an agreement that they got billions of rands of tax deductions that they were sending to the local market at competitive prices, they used that and then, I don't know what the word is, they then said, oh, we won't send it to the local market with these plants, they're for export only. And thereby, we get away with that clause, we get around that clause. Right. Let's go back about 2 million years. Your first mining in South Africa starts with early hominids, and those are basically stone tools. But we move forward very fast, and we have our first iron ore, hematite, long walked about 75,000 years ago, and this is your first human writing or human art. And this is your first iron ore mining, I think, worldwide. The next is your first underground mine, the Ingwenya mine in Swaziland, about 20,000 years ago, where again, iron ore was mined for ochre, for rock painting, yellow paint, red paint, black paint. And then we move forward again into metallurgy, and from about 2,000 years ago, all over South Africa, we have iron being iron ore being smelted into implements such as hoes, arrows, assegais, etc. And there are literally thousands of sites across our country and Southern Africa. This is a photograph of the 1880s. And then moving later, about 1,000 years ago, into widespread gold mining, such as Mapungubwe, where there are over 4,000 ancient workings and gold mines across Southern Africa, and that trade went as far as China, India, etc., as we can see from the artifacts. So for basically longer than anywhere in the world, we've had mining for the local economy to benefit the local economy. Suddenly we have a colonial invasion, alienation of the land and the minerals, mining integrated now into the conquerors' economies, the European economy, as Rhodes said, the colonies are there as a source of raw materials and a market for Great Britain. He was quite an honest fellow. Local entrepreneurs from the early days in Kimberley were excluded from the industry except as labour. Racial exploitation intensified under apartheid. 94, we have liberation or democracy, and question mark, minerals for the development of all South Africans. And this is the task of all of us here, as either members of the populace or representatives of the populace. Steel in development. What is the role of steel in development? Steel is absolutely critical to development. About 1.3 billion tons of steel are consumed annually. This is about 10 times more than all other metals combined. So when you think manufacturing, think copper, zinc, nickel, tin, etc. once, and think steel 13 times. It's the most important feedstock. It is the raw material of industrialization. It is critical to having a competitive manufacturing sector. Without it, you're dead in the water. And that's one of the reasons we have problems exporting. And there you can see in that graph also the rise of China, now representing about a third of global steel production. South Africa wobbling along with recent decreases, but as we heard earlier, some of these decreases are also due to refurbishments at 8 to 9 million tons. steel, as I said, is the most important of all the crude commodities, and of all metals, and of all feedstocks, only crude oil is bigger than steel. Then if we look at the global intensity of use of steel, we have a long period from the Second World War till about 1980 of high intensity, high prices, robust growth, provoked by the reconstruction of the rich countries, the OECD countries, the putting in of schools, highways, the putting in of housing, etc. And also people buying their first cars, pop-up toasters, washing machines, etc., etc. And then we see the intensity drop, because now they've penetrated these markets. Those economies continue to grow, but they grow into services. So most of them now, services are about two-thirds of their GDP. We then have a period of low intensity, terrible prices. The first world, cheap like anything. They subsidize their steel industries, 80 billion pumped into the EU, 30 billion according to the GO into the Americans, because no one wants to let go of a steel industry, even when they've run out of the ore, they've run out of the reductants. Even old Holland wants a steel industry. No ore, no nothing, but it's like a national airline or a flag, so you subsidize it. Live just like they do to the agriculture. What does that do? It means the export price becomes a dump price. Fell right down in 1999 to $165 a ton for hot-rolled coil. No one can produce with that because everyone is cheating. So the price on the export market falls below the cost of the cheapest reducer, which economists will tell us is impossible. But it's very possible if subsidies are right. Then we have a change. From 2000, we see that intensity curve shoot up. This is the amount of steel in a unit of GDP globally. And this is basically China, and this is a new opportunity for us, both in steel and downstream, is my argument. This is looking at individual countries, and it's quite uncanny, this turning point where they put in all of the houses, highways, schools, etc., and they've all bought all of their bits and pieces, their white goods, their automobiles, etc. It happens just about to every country, no matter when it happens, at about $16,000 per capita. And you can see that inflection point. Of course, the countries keep growing. So where are we? The People's Republic of China is about only one-third up that graph, and India is only one-third that of China. And the combined population of the two of them is nearly three times that of the first world. So the world is going to need three times more resources if we make the assumption that all of the Indians and Chinese want all of the goodies that the first world has. When are prices going to fall? According to this graph, they look at the 1.45 billion people, that's the projected population of China, and that intensity is going to start falling in 2025. But what about the next billion? The next billion, India is over a billion. Southeast Asia, Vietnam, Pumpy, Indonesia, all of those together. What about South America? And more importantly, what about Africa? That's another billion. Will we be the last billion to move up that curve? So this could be a very, very long boom. This recent crisis was completely self-inflicted, this U.S. toxic debt. I think most people agree it need not have happened if there had been correct regulation and certain regulations had not been removed. So we are already recovering from this recent crisis. It's already on the up again, prices are recovered. This is an OECD view of this intensity. They call the first phase the glorious Western 30 years. They then call the next phase the ugly 20 for the steel producers, and now we have this new Asian phase. Where does steel go? How is it used in different countries? Quite differently. In Europe, you can see it's mainly into manufacturing, appliances, etc., small amounts into construction. But in a developing country like China, construction is nearly half of all steel consumed, and that's what other developing countries also show, and very high on shipbuilding. And Japan, again, small construction, they built all their buildings, but big shipbuilding. This is steel where we are per capita, and you can see South Africa at the end of there. We're very high compared to the rest of Africa. We're about 180 kilotons per person. Sorry, 100 kilograms. Kilograms per person. And this is some of the steel-intensive goods in general. Capital goods is where we want to be. Capital goods are steel-intensive. And what's not on this graph is shipbuilding, which is, I just remembered that because South Korea actually put in a steel industry because they had the aim of going into shipbuilding and thereafter automobiles, and all of that has happened in our history. This is what the industry looks like globally. Very high levels of concentration upstream when you get into the actual basic oxygen furnace, electric arc furnaces, there are more, about 822 plants, going down to the makers of the semi, and then into various sectors. As I said, in all of the so-called developmental states or command economies, the state ensured that steel was supplied at competitive prices. Often, these companies worked at utility returns, which usually is 6% returns. They were specially put in because they realized the importance of the platform of steel and polymers. The other one, like the CPDC in Taiwan, the China Petroleum Development Corporation, saw the importance of polymers. Now, polymers are the second biggest material. They're about 400 million tons. That's, again, four times more than all other metals, so second to steel. So basically, what is a motor vehicle? It's a lump of steel and plastic. Different kinds of steels, different alloys, etc., and plastics with talc added. In South Africa, you can see some data here that was presented to you before by DPI of steel in a range of various products. Oh, yeah. Sorry. Well, you've got it earlier from DPI. It was in their presentation. I'm afraid. Sorry. South Africa's natural resources, this is our natural comparative advantage. This is what early development you normally rely on. What you have is in minerals and energy, agriculture and husbandry, forestry and biomass, water, fisheries, tourism, which is mainly natural resource endowed, like national parks, beaches, mountains, etc. However, of these only, I would say, this is my opinion, the mineral and tourism resources could be considered exceptional in global terms. Our energy is problematic with global warming, and we're a water-scarce country with two-thirds of our country having precipitation of less than 500 mils, the minimum for dryland cropping. So, I'm not going to talk about tourism, but we're going to talk about our minerals. So, South Africa is well endowed with critical mineral feedstocks to underpin a competitive economy. Iron ore into steel for manufacturing, construction, as I showed, coal into polymers, coal into energy, which goes into all activities, fertilizer minerals into agriculture, base metals into manufacturing and construction, ferroalloys into manufacturing. However, the mineral-based feedstocks are generally sold at predatory prices, monopoly prices, or IPP, as we heard earlier, severely compromising any downstream jobs. South Africa is also well endowed with the main minerals for steel making for a competitive manufacturing sector. We have the iron ore, we have large resources at Sishen, and we even have 10 times bigger resources in the Bushveld that are at the moment less economic and only Highveld mines than at Mapoch. We have coal and coking coal, we have ferroalloys, we're the second biggest producer in the world, we have the necessary fluxes, and we have the electricity from the coal. However, the resultant iron and steel is made available again at predatory or monopoly or IPP, destroying tens of thousands of potential downstream jobs in manufacturing. My guesstimate is about 100,000 jobs. Yet the minerals belong to the people as a whole. I'm not saying where that quote comes from. with 30% unemployment. This is ludicrous. We're sitting with 30% unemployment, we have all of the raw materials, and we're allowing the people who mine in our raw materials, belonging to our people, to get away with monopoly pricing at the first stage of dirt digging, destroying all the downstream jobs. Do we have styrofoam for brains? Very expensive styrofoam, it's monopoly priced as well. Quite that one. Here's a breakdown from Steel on the Net of steel costs for a basic oxygen furnace. And you can see your highest are the ore, the next is the coal, and the next is steel scrap. Then in the end, I've added a column, South Africa, and where I think we've got a massive advantage, I'll put three pluses. Where we've got a good advantage, I'll put two. Where we have a advantage, I'll put one. And then I put a squiggle where we're roughly the same as elsewhere in the world, like on scrap prices. And I put a negative where we're higher than the rest of the world, which is on interest rates. So there's one interest rate to 12% are the only negative you have in doing business here. And that only applies to the extent that you're in debt or what your gearing ratio is. Beyond the hole in the ground, how can we use our resources which are unsustainable? Every mine will one day be a Stilfontein or a Veldt. No matter what Anglo tells you or BHPD, there's no such thing as sustainable mining. It's a finite resource, it will be mined out. So how do you make it sustainable? The way other countries made it sustainable is to optimize the linkages whilst you have it. Britain was the world's biggest mining country in 1850. They optimized the linkages, the minerals ran out, they continued with the linkages, the upstream linkages and the downstream linkages into mining and other resources. What are these linkages? The first one that sort of World Bank will always go on and on about is capturing the resource rents, but that is not the most important. The most important, it gives you the infrastructural linkages, the resources put in your infrastructure. We're well aware of that. We have infrastructure radiating from Gauteng, like rail, etc., all put in by gold mines. Upstream inputs. This is by far the most important sector. This is your capital goods, plant machinery, equipment, consumables, etc. The upstream ones are the ones, if you look at other countries like Finland, Sweden, the upstream inputs reinvent themselves into new sectors, like Nokia, like into Scania trucks, from mining trucks, etc. Because they're engineer intensive, they reinvent themselves and move down. This is a sector where we're going backwards. We've seen the R&D move offshore. We allowed companies to relist. They shut down. Mittal shut down all the massive ISCOR R&D and innovation, because of course he's got big R&D facilities back in Belgium, etc. THPB did the same, they shut down the JTC, Johannesburg Technology Center, and moved it all to Kangaroo Land, to Australia. So what we've seen in South Africa, by opening up, by being a little bit naive when listening to the people from the Bretton Woods Institution thinking it was going to be all hunky-dory, we've gone backwards. And then, of course, the downstream linkages over here, of course, into steel, semis, etc., that I've spoken about already. I'm fairly radical on this. I've been in the minerals business now longer than I want to admit, but I graduated with geology from this university in 1972, so close on 40 years I've been in the minerals business. I would not mine if you can't make the linkages. The minerals have been in the bushveld for 2 billion years. Don't worry, they'll stay another 2 billion. If you can't make these critical linkages, leave them. They are national assets, and unless you can optimize that asset, it's a finite asset, leave them in the ground. We've done the opposite. We've just handed everything up and said, go for it, dig the dirt, send it off. We'll re-import it as motor vehicles and finished items from China and Japan, etc. It's nice being an independent consultant. I don't have to worry what my minister thinks anymore. These are all of the inputs at every stage of your mineral filia or pipeline, from exploration all the way down to fabrication. These are all opportunities. Why are these opportunities, these input opportunities? Because we have a relatively low, large local market. South Africa is only 1.5% of the global market for, say, pop-up stoves. But at least 10% for mining chemicals. Germany doesn't have a market that big. So in our resource sectors, whether it's minerals or agriculture, we suddenly have a relatively large local market. And it's the economies of scale on our side. The second is you have to adapt these technologies for local conditions. So you find a lot of our capital goods, mining equipment, etc., was developed because we have to. We had particular types of ore, we had to develop particular circuits, etc. They were then applicable elsewhere. So that challenge, that threat became an opportunity. And finally, this, and in the case of minerals, this is a national asset. You can concession an asset with any conditions you like, WTO the good. Just like the private sector does. You know, you lease a house and there are all kinds of funny conditions about how loud the music and so on. And if you don't comply, the lease is taken back. So because this is a national asset, it allows for the linkages to be in fact stipulated if we wanted to do that. This is a tale of not two cities, a tale of two countries. These are the Hawthorne U curves, which show your degree of industrialization, its employment in manufacturing against your income per capita. And over here you can see, if you look at my cursor, you can see Chile on the 1960 MF or manufacturing curve. So they were industrializing, they were on the global manufacturing curve, 1970 they're on it. And then suddenly they dive down, and by 1996, 98, they're on the primary commodities, the Banana Republic curve. So what happened? They had a coup, they brought in the Chicago School and the Washington Consensus, and although they grew, they went backwards. They grew by producing different types of bananas. They used to only sell copper bananas, now they sell salmon bananas, wood bananas, but bananas. They deindustrialized. And then you have another country called Finland. Very clearly in 1960, a banana republic. Rice, selling wood bananas, mineral bananas. And then it moved by 1980, it hits the manufacturing curve. How did it do that? And it did it by making the linkages. If you look at the black bar there, crashes. That's raw wood chips. They could have just sold their wood as chips or logs. They did it. They went up. They went upstream into wood machinery. All the capital goods, all the services, the biggest consulting companies in forestry are from Finland, like Yapukuri, etc. So what they did was that they basically deepened their industry until today they have left the industry and they are in the linkage industry. Now, in South Africa and Africa as a whole, we have chosen to develop craft with the mantra of direct foreign investment, which I agree with, don't get me wrong. To rapidly, not to rely on local capital accumulation mainly, but to import capital and skills through transnational corporations, or TNCs. In South Africa, we actually had our own sort of TNCs and we allowed them all out. I have no idea why. Through relistings or sales, they are now foreign companies. Most of the South African companies in mining are now foreign. They are Anglo's in London, and De Beers is in Luxembourg, and Genco is now in Sydney, or Melbourne, I'm not sure where the headquarters is, etc. CMI is now with Xstrata. Basically, it's the same has happened here, even though we once had first, is that we've got to realize that there's this trade-off. It's a quick and easy to bring in foreign capital and skills, but it comes with several threats. The first is they have global purchasing strategies. They're not going to develop your input sector. Anglo, when it was here, did. Now they purchase internationally. They optimize their global processing downstream because they've got plants all over the world with what fits to optimize the returns to their shareholders. Everything they do here, from a shareholder point of view, makes total sense. That makes nonsense from a South Africa point of view. If it was a local company, of course, they wouldn't have overseas facilities. And that's your normal trajectory. They locate their tech development. As I said, Mittal has closed out. They transferred, they had a massive research development. They were developing new iron-making processes, IFCON, and developing all kinds of technologies around steel. What was there, they went to the University of Pretoria, and has now been slimmed down to just about nothing. The same, as I said, has happened with all of these other exits. We've seen the real gem that we need for development, the knowledge-intensive industries, disappear, and we've moved into the basic bananas or dirty. The R&D, they locate offshore in the OECD countries, and of course the political downside to your national assets being predominantly owned by foreign capital, and we need to work on that. And finally, this new mantra of the transnational corporations that one has been reading about for the last 10 years, of core competence, unbundled, realized shareholder value, has made them increasingly irrelevant. The old mining house, with all of the linkages, was very relevant. We still have them in India, like the Bombay Club, like Tata, from lipstick to steel. And what we have now is Anglo slimmed down to dirt diggers. They're all dirt diggers now, and increasingly irrelevant to our developmental agenda. However, don't get me wrong, I'm not saying throw them out. I'm not saying nationalize them either. I'm saying all of these threats can be overcome or mediated through being smart, through appropriate state actions, policies, and interventions. One of the basic problems we have is that we have a mining code here that is normally called free mining, which is a colonial code that allows for the right of free access. Someone can go make an application one day and a few days later get 900 million apparently in the press. Right? And what did he or she do? Nothing. It's free entry. It's also the right to take possession of that land and the right to start a mine. Now, where did this law come from? It didn't come from the colonial powers. Back in the metropoles, they didn't have the free mining law. They had the minerals belonged to the royalty under the feudal system or to the state. They had tiny little areas like Freiburg in Germany where they had free mining, but that was less than 5% of Europe. But in order to colonize, to wipe out the locals and colonize, mining was great because you could leave Europe and encourage you to go off and conquer new areas, and it was a method of encouraging dispossession and colonization, and it worked. This type of law was first formulated in California and then copied in the other colonies. And it was a great attraction. We didn't have to have assisted passage anymore. They'd come themselves to come and take a claim and get rich, like Guggenheim in America, etc. And we all know that was our law. You know, the diamond rush and then the Barberton gold rush, etc., etc. And it was very effective at bringing Mulungus out to the colonies, because there was a cost to having colonies, and the more you could get settlers, then you might get an income from them. Now, this type of law which the MPRDA is based on, is this really in the interest of South Africa? And it's also, as we're aware, it's the origin of the Keo-AMSA mineral rights mess, is this law. How do we extract greater benefits, and what I'm recommending here is going beyond free mining regimes, but I do still see a role for free mining. The thing is, we mustn't expect that they go find minerals. They don't go find minerals. Tell me anyone on the, or any new mine on the Merensky, on the platinum, who's found it. None of them. They got mineral rights. They went to state place. It was known they were there. So, what we should do is divide exploration terrain into unknown, where we don't know, no assets, partially known, and known assets. In the unknown areas, I would recommend a type of free mining, because if there's an unknown state asset, we don't actually have that asset, and if the private sector entrepreneur is going to go and discover it for us, then we give them automaticity with conditions to a mining license, because they have added to the people's asset base, right? But this is only where there's no known, and that's very, I know of no new mine or prospecting right that falls into that category in the last 10 years in South Africa. They're all being known. One proviso is you must not have a normal profit tax, because you want to garner the very high differential rent. Inherent in mining, you need a rate of return tax, like the old gold tax, based on profitability, not profit, or a resource rent tax that we've heard all about in Australia, but many countries have had it. And that's a tax that triggers in once you've made the expected rate of return for that market. David Ricardo put it this way. The price of wheat will clear in the north of England at the average return to capital for the north of England. But some farmers are on loamy ground and they will make a higher rate. And that is a luck rate. That is, without adding labor, without adding innovation, without adding capital. Some people are on higher grade resources. So what it says is we don't know what your grade and amenability is, but once you've made the expected rate of return, you then the secondary tax or resource rent tax will trigger in. I'm a great fan of it because it doesn't disincentivize anyone. If it's marginal, you'll never pay it. If you're on stony ground or you've got a low-grade resource, you'll never pay that tax because you will not make the expected rate of return. If it's known, then we should do what we do for other state assets. It should be transparently and competitively concessioned as an auction. And in the auction, what is price discovery? Price discovery is the NPV of all the revenue streams to the state over the life of the concession. So clearly, the rent share should be a criteria, part of the weighting of the concession. So you bid up the tax. That way you leave it up to the market to determine the tax rate. They will bid it up to where they are comfortable that they feel they get in their share. Infrastructure development. Up and downstream, or the linkages development. Indigenization, or state free carry, whatever route you want to go. What R&D are you going to bring here? What HRD are you going to do here? All of these and community development. Normally, when I advise other governments in Africa, rent share is about 40% of the weighting. The linkage up and down is about 30, and the others about 5-10 each. And then you have a point system, and you have a clear winner. The person who's given the most developmental impact to that result wins the concession. And then for the partially known, where we're not sure, not even at an inferred result, so you can't really concession it yet, then the geosurvey department here, the Council for Geoscience, should be resolved to go into those areas to determine is there a known asset, in which case it goes into the known category, or really there's nothing here, and if a private sector guy has a great idea and can find something, then good luck to him or her. And they can then have automaticity. And that means the free mining system. So I'm saying you have a limited free mining system for areas of unknown resources. For all the rest, you don't allow someone to go and slip in with different dates on different, you know, you've got an application form and then make a lot of money a few weeks later without adding any value. This again you've seen before, this also I stole from the DTI presentation, but it gives an idea. This is the work that was done in Ekurhuleni of the firms, how they would react to lower steel prices. We heard today it's something like 40%, so there isn't even a 40%. If you went 40, and in some cases it's 50% higher, that we had a competitive price, we should have two more roads there. 40%, 50%, and it would keep shooting up. So the employment losses, my back of an envelope guess, are about 100,000 on steel. And at a dependency ratio in our country of 10 to 1, that is 1 million South Africans that could have plates on their dinner table that don't. Just to recap what I've said, first is resource exploitation, processing, and then intermediate feedstocks like steel. We need to make all of the side stream linkages and the backward linkages. We need to make all of the infrastructure linkages into our rural areas, into isolated areas to catalyze other sectors that are sustainable, such as agriculture and tourism. And these then need to be the basic feedstock platform of very competitive, if not utility prices, into a competitive manufacturing sector. So basically, use the Asian resource boom at the moment to kickstart a resource based on African development strategy as part of an overall strategy. Right, my final slide. The current mess. I find it totally, first of all, we messed up when we heard how we messed up there was an input price determined, but we never got the output price. So they got iron ore at cost plus 3%, and then they were able to rip our economy off because that wasn't tied down. My advice to the representatives of our people sitting here is the state must cancel this prospecting license immediately in the national interest. If the current holders take the state to court, then so be it. The loss to the economy would be way, way, way greater than any compensation we might have to pay the current holders for any money they might have spent in the last 12 months doing I don't know what. This must be cancelled. Then, the steel task, the interdepartmental task team, should enter into negotiations with AMSA to give them access to those resources on condition that we have implementable and enforceable competitive pricing. See, we might have them in a corner, we might even get better than competitive pricing and get utility pricing, but at least competitive pricing into the domestic market. And it should be clear, and we should get an army of lawyers to make it clear that the license will be withdrawn as soon as prices shoot above them. So you don't go to the Competition Commission, and you can throw immediately there's a complaint, not to the Competition Commission, but back to government, that they are overcharging and it can be proven you withdraw the license. It's like any condition that you have on any lease. This is a lease. If AMSA don't play ball, if they say, no, we're not willing to do that, that means that we're in too narrow profit margins, etc., then the state should put the property out to auction against the establishment of a new steel plant that would sell at EPP. Now, we've spoken to Indian and Chinese steelmakers, we've had several times, we've never been able to get the mineral resources because they've been handed out to God knows who. But twice now, they would have been willing to, twice now, we have first Sino Steel, we've also had ESSA in India, they would have put in a steel plant here, two discipline missiles, had we made four available to them. Instead, we made four available, well, you know who we made it available to, the new entry. So I don't mean the Kunga Hall, that was, they were already mining that. I'm talking about the unoccupied ones we made available. So, if necessary, we should also bundle other FE iron resources into this deal because there might not be enough ore in that little contested area to get a player to come in and put in a steel plant and for them to export ore. That's usually the quid pro quo with the Chinese and Indians. You know, they agreed to 20 million tons, of which 5 million tons would be converted into 3 million tons of steel. That would be fine for disciplining metal. But we need that other 15 million tons because very few people want to do battle on the world steel market whilst the first world still cheap and subsidized because you might just get a price that's totally unsustainable. So they all rely mainly on their domestic market. That's it. Oh no, there were a few other actions. I forgot. One last slide. Sorry. We also need to amend the MPRDA to make the realization of these developmental linkages an explicit objective of the Act. We tried to do that at the time in 2002 and that wasn't put in. So if you read the objectives of the Act, the creation of the critical linkages, up and backward and forward linkages, isn't in the objective. It therefore makes it difficult for the Minister to impose that as a condition on the license. Because if it's not in the condition, in the objective, it's difficult to impose. That would allow the minister to impose all of these nice things on a license. And we need to consider now, right away, this has been recommended before to DME at the time, now DMR, that, and in fact the wording was even done, that a competitive pricing condition is built into every single mining license that obligates the concessionaire to sell all mineral products into the local market at an export parity price. And so that we don't get Sasol just separating off the coal mine and doing the monopoly pricing at the next step, we need that to unobligate any local customers likewise. And that must just be a condition of them being allowed to definitively take the people's assets. Because mining is a wasting asset. At the end of that, there will be no asset. So I don't see a problem. There's no problem with putting that on new licenses, but we also need to look at retroactively putting this condition on all licenses. And it's a reasonable thing to do, just to say you must sell at a competitive price. And I would go further and recommend to you the freezing of granting of all further exploration licenses until the Council for Geoscience has determined that the area has no known resources. All known resources should be transparently and competitively auctioned against developmental criteria and leakages that would create jobs for our people. Thank you very much.
I must say that was a very, very challenging, informative, and gave this committee an opportunity to see things a little differently. Thank you very much, Dr. Paul Jordan. We welcome this, any different view that can add light on what is also a very complex issue. And your input is very welcome. Over to the committee to raise their questions now in the next questions and responses, 20 minutes. Thank you. Yes, Honourable Albert, Honourable Turok, Honourable Ndikalana, Honourable Harris. Looking around. Just a minute. Anyone else? No. There won't be a second group of questions. That's what I'm asking. I'll have a question then at the end. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is quite an interesting and comprehensive proposal. Is this quite unique? Is this your own design, if I can put it that way? Has anything like this ever been implemented elsewhere in the world that we can learn the lessons? Obviously, this is an intervention where the state tries to structure the economy to a degree, and obviously the free market thinkers would not like this at all, the libertarian thinkers. Is there any study whether this would work as opposed to just letting the free market do what it's supposed to do, you know, the invisible hand, so to speak? I have a very pragmatic viewpoint on these things, so I would just like to know whether things work or not in the end of the day, as opposed to just having an ideological viewpoint. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Paul.
Yeah, I'm back. I'd love to have a copy of your memorandum that you gave to the then Minister Trevor Manuel. I'd love to have a copy if you've got that, because clearly you were trying to set a trend and it wasn't accepted. But maybe at this stage one can say that it may might have a lot of value. So if you can, I'd love a copy. Secondly, you did lose me a bit, because you dealt an awful lot with stuff which is dealt with by the Minerals Committee rather than ours. And I got lost. Maybe you dealt with so much that my concentration left. But what I found very interesting and important for this committee in particular is your comment about how you intervene for the purposes of industrialization.
And if I may just say that I interviewed Simon Roberts recently for New Agenda. This is a little advert, and the interview will go into the next issue. And at the end of the interview, it took me a long time getting there, he said that there are many interventions that a state can make, short of nationalization, and which are perfectly legitimate in terms of WTO rules, et cetera, which we are not making. And it seems to me, for me, with the important part of your presentation, of course, the rest of it is terribly interesting. Yeah. The important part is, what can this committee and DTI actually implement, which we're not implementing, and which is perfectly legitimate in terms of WTO rules, et cetera, and it seems to me that you and Simon are talking the same language, but we don't know what that is very clearly.
Thank you very much, Honourable Nicola.
Thank you very much, sir. Dr. Duna, in view of quite a number of issues that you have raised, I'll just pick up a few. The fact that you are proposing that the government emphasizes the focus on recent tax rates in health compared to tax rates in debt and profit of agriculturalized and also the loss of opportunities, one, employment opportunities, two, the more players in the industry, in many consumers and the incumbents. Of course, in the current system, you know, the more players, it's something that is going to be competition, of course, effective oligopoly or all kinds of uncompetitive behavior. But you also mentioned that there are current negotiations. But what I think that, it seems to be pandering to us that government should be a little bit, or should be rather assertive in creating a regulatory framework in this strategic industry, as compared to just merely negotiating. Am I reading you correctly? That's the main thing. The second one, share, is more of a request that it would be helpful if you could share more information rather than just PowerPoint presentation on your proposal on the regionalization drive that is vis-a-vis SACU and others. Because this committee as well also is filled with grappling with that and engaging the department to how we look at regional economic integration structures. Thanks.
Thank you, Honourable Nicolana. Honourable
Harris. Thank you. Chair, to my mind, this presentation makes three basic proposals. The one that Honourable Tura pointed out is unfortunately not in the mandate of the department or the committee is the reform of the mining laws. I think there's some very good ideas there, and I hope you present them to the relevant committee. But frustratingly, I would imagine they're out of our reach. Then there's two proposals. The one is around and this isn't really dealt with, but the infrastructure constraints in mining. You deal with it partially in the beginning, which really sets up the playing field for existing mines to produce and export. Now I think the idea that we lost out on the mining boom 2003 to 2008. It's got nothing to do with the upstream and downstream linkages. It's the fact that we were producing these minerals, but we weren't taking advantage of the boom that was happening. It was a critique of our existing mining capacity that didn't step up. And I think the reason it didn't step up is because of the infrastructure, because of the rail and terminal capacity, and because of energy prices. And I really hope that in this committee we can work on those issues. On making sure that the infrastructure is there to support the expansion of our mines. But nevertheless, I think the linkages argument is a very good one. And obviously there's a debate that perhaps we need to have on the set of interventions which appear in the 5 or 6 pages towards the end of the presentation, in terms of how involved the state needs to get in those, and the role of the DTI in making those interventions. But, Chair, that's a debate. I think this committee must have. I haven't had enough time to absorb all of these things right now, but I think a lot of them do have merit. And then just a last question to tag on to the end. There's a lot of conversation internationally about the importance of China and India and how they represent the future given the size of their markets. But I think one of the natural advantages that South Africa has is the billion consumers that are to the north of us. I would appreciate it.
On the line, I was hoping you'd stay because we've got minutes to pass. On the line.
My question is, still as an industry, are we set up in South Africa to benefit from the eventual development of the country to our north and be the steel provider right now? So if a country is industrializing like Senegal or Nigeria, where do they get their steel from? And is it possible that South Africa could be that destination or is there kind of overland or shipping routes? Or do they make South African steel too?
Thank you. Over to yourself then, Dr. Jovan.
Thank you. Very interesting question. First is it Honourable Albert. Is this unique? I'm not quite sure what you're referring to. On the linkages, absolutely not. In the hidden slides, I've given you the Norwegian strategy where you can clearly see in that slide the oil disappearing, but because of the linkages, you see it continue into the technology, into the downstream, etc. And it is a very clear strategy in Finland through the TECES under the Prime Minister. They invested in the upstream with their CSR called BTT, Tamburi University. And today, the biggest opportunity for trackless mining in the world is our Bushveld complex, the platinum mining. And it's all going to be imported because we dropped the ball. We don't have a research capacity anymore. There used to be Comro on mining equipment. It was 600 strong. It was bigger than Mintec. And today, they then dropped it in the slump of the early 90s. It went to the CSR and it's now 45 people. So we didn't develop an LHC, a low-haul dump vehicle, low profile. I'm aware that Bell did do a prototype design, but we didn't come to the party like the Finns do with the state to fund that prototype. So yes, it's been done from the linkages point of view by many countries, have made those linkages and have a strategy around it. And that strategy is around R&D and HRD. When you ask the Finns what is the most important thing the state did, they say engineers, more engineers. And in that area, it's another thing that's not your committee, but we are failing. High grade maths and science, we are not doing very well. Free market. Look, which is more free market? Putting something out to auction for price discovery or allowing someone to walk in the back door and get it? Surely an auction, price discovery is free market, like the electromagnetic spectrum in Britain that was auctioned, and New Zealand, etc. I'm just saying the thing that minerals are different. Every other state actor, we use the market system to try and flush out fair value. Except minerals, because we inherited this colonial mineral free mining law that was put in by the Europeans as a method of incentivizing colonization and getting immigrants to go. And it worked. I mean, they went in their millions. There are 300 million of them in the US today. And indigenous people, I think, almost probably down to 1-2 million. Or Australia, 360,000 indigenous people and 20 million immigrants. Anyway, so what I'm saying is that this particular area where suddenly the World Bank will always advise all states to get transparent competitive value for state assets, except for them. No, just let in the transnationals. They're very good. They'll do it all. For, with no attempt at price discovery. Ben, I did look for that memo to Trevor, just out of interest, and I've gone through so many computers since 96, I can't find it anymore.
I was going to stop you right there. You told me you didn't work for BTI.
No, I did work for
BTI. Right, no longer. And what we were going to do is to approach BTI. That's the property of BTI.
Yeah.
So I don't want a discussion of it. Thank you.
Sure. In fact, that was going to be my suggestion. What can be implemented? In the hidden slides, I go through clear implementation downstream, and I can give you the presentation, and it would take too long. But you can use export taxes on WTO, legit. China uses them. If there's a clear case for beneficiation, which is in your remit, whilst the mining is in another committee's remit, if you put in a reasonable small export tax, that obviously means that the beneficiated product would not attract that tax, and it's used widely. and it's WTO legit. You could have royalty that some countries already do, that decrease with increasing value addition. You could use utility prices as well to incentivize. For instance, rail. If you want to export dirt down the line, it'll be more expensive than if you want to export iron down the line. And you can do the same with electricity, etc. So there are many, many levers that the state could use to help the private sector to do the right thing. Also, I sent the committee the full document that is behind this presentation. I don't know if you got it. Oh, I did send it to you via WeTransfer. But anyway, I can send it to you again, or just give it to you on the flash right now. The Honourable Shikalala, rate of return is a, what am I saying? I'm saying a tax on your profitability rather than profit, so that it's not a flat tax. And we've had one for 100 years here under the Gold Mining Formula Tax, which is a tax on your revenue over, your profit over your turnover times the constant. That constant is critical. So as that goes up, your tax rate goes up. But it can also fall to zero if you're a marginal miner. And then the resource rent tax, which I prefer, which is a tax that triggers in after the expected rate of return is achieved. And most countries use the long bond treasury rate because that is a reflection of the risk, the sovereign risk of a country. If that risk goes up, the long bond rate goes up, it goes down, the rate goes down. Plus, what the average differential between that and the average return on the stock exchange is. And I've always recommended 5%. I see the Australians have gone for 7. So it's long bond plus 7 there, I would go long bond plus 5. And say that's a reasonable return. Once you've achieved that return, this tax triggers it. Because that means you have an exceptional resource, and that resource belongs to the state. Proactive rather than just a regulation. Clearly, minerals are a state asset, and the state is obligated to be proactive. The state is meant to be the parent, or whatever the word is, the guardian of those resources on behalf of the people. So it can't just be, I know it is at the moment just regulation, but it's got to be totally proactive. These are wasting assets. If we don't optimize their developmental impact in the window while they're being mined before we get a silt contain, it's gone forever. The window closes. Once there's a hole in the ground, it's over. So, yes, I would argue very strongly. The structural and static dimension, what I'm arguing there with our small market, if we want to get into the upstream, remember Finland has the European market, that's what they went for in their upstream, paper, pulp, machinery, capital goods, which if you go to Outlong, you'll see that many finished machinery. They had the Russian and the Soviet Union and the European market. if we want to put in world scale plants for, say, LHD, we're going to have to expand our market. Plus, there are enormous opportunities in the region, unrealized opportunities. So mining is taking off in the region, in the southern African region, and it will increase. And I would argue very strongly we have to increase that market size. Africa is a myth. We may be on that continent, but all the barriers between us and getting into those markets are such that until we move towards the customs union and the free movement, at least maybe not of people to start with, but of goods and capital, it's like not having that market. In fact, in Angola, which now earns $70 billion a year in oil, they're nearly 2 million barrels a day, all the products when you're in Rwanda are coming across from Brazil. It's easier for them. It's easier to get to Rwanda from Brazil than it is from Johannesburg. And we obviously are in no trade agreement with them. They're not part of SACA. Honourable Harris, yes, you're right, a lot was mentioned. I did ask if it could be a joint sitting with the Minerals Committee. I also spoke to the Honourable Mr. Goma, and he hoped, I spoke to him on Saturday, he hoped that it could be a joint sitting. And I would strongly recommend a joint sitting around this issue. Because, yes, minerals are with the Minerals Committee, but the backward and forward linkages are all in this committee. And it's you know, just the way that Parliament has decided to do its committees shouldn't stop a coherent strategy. In Angola, they've just joined the two ministries. It's now the Ministry of Industry and Minerals together. Maybe that's a good idea. I don't know. Infrastructure. Did we miss the boom? I had a hidden slide on it, and you're right, there have been a lot of opportunistic statements coming from people like the Chamber of Mines saying that the reason that we didn't grow into the boom between 2002 and 2008 was because of the onerous mining regime here, and BE and all of those things, you know, employment equity. But if you then go mineral by mineral, which I've done there on this sheet which you've got in the handout, you'll see that PGM, if it was a flat line, it meant you kept your market share, right? So flat line means you perform fine. But we see PGMs, we increased our market share, so we more than grew into the boom, we overgrew into the boom. If we start looking at the others, gold's in terminal decline. Gold's not going to climb into anything. You know, at peak of 1,000 tons in about 1970, you know, we're below 200 tons now. That's the wasting asset. Most of the mines are dead. For coal, we lost market share, as you say, because of the rate of constraint. For iron ore, we lost market share again because of the Transnet constraint. Chromium, we slightly lost market share, even though ferrochrome was severely constrained by the power shortages, the power intensity. Manganese, we kept market share despite rail constraint. And copper, with Kalaboa going underground at a much lower rate of production, we're constrained by resources, and our other copper is a byproduct, and therefore is not elastic. Is not that the elasticity of supply is zero. It can only move with the price of platinum. It can't move with the price of copper. It's a byproduct. And that gives you the graph, and you can see that it's very... Well, I call it opportunistic to try and get some rent-seeking from government by saying that the reason we didn't grow to the boom was because of an onerous regime, which I don't think is at all onerous, that should be scrapped. And I think that was enough. Oh, then the African market. I think I've asked. So steel opportunities is a difficult one. I've done an analysis across Africa, and Africa has many iron and ore deposits with reductants. Now, for the future, your best reductant is not coking coal because of global warming. It is gas. You can reform the gas into hydrogen and carbon monoxide, and then steam shift it into more hydrogen and carbon dioxide, which is then concentrated and can be sequestrated. You then make steel using hydrogen as a reductant, not carbon. A you produce byproduct water. So you take an iron oxide, you add hydrogen, you get a water, hydrogen oxide, and iron steel. So you get what's called green steel. Now, there are many countries in Africa with gas and iron ore. So I think initially, yes, if we moved, there would be a market for South Africa. But over time, especially West Africa, where there's a lot of gas, they would certainly be making their own steel. East Africa less so, and Central less so. They are potential markets. But that, as I said, they don't exist. We only part of Africa as far as you look at a map. From a trade forces point of view, it's cheaper to get things into Dar es Salaam from Kaohsiung than it is. It's cheaper to get from China into Dar es Salaam than it is from Kaohsiung. That's it. Thank you.
Well, we must really thank you very much, Dr. Jordan, and I hope I know that the committee particularly wanted to just discuss, I think, with you before you left. And certainly for myself, we would see commissioners just not here at the moment. Down there, yes, okay. All to have the opportunity to talk to you, but we just need to get through half an hour, please. Thank you. Now, members, what we're going to do now is I just need to refer to the WHO report. I imagine that.
Chair, excuse me. I have something at 1 o'clock. If you want to vote, then please, can we do it first?
I will say one.
I'm asking you a request.
That's enough.
I beg your pardon.
I said it's enough. We are finished. We want you.
I don't think you should address me like that, if you don't mind. I made a request to you. I don't think you should tell me that's enough. Okay? That's rude.
1 or 2 minutes, because we can't deal with it. The reason we can't deal with it is very simple. There are a number of factual errors in the report. And the content specialist would like the opportunity to clean it up. So, if you do have it, if you come across more factual errors, please inform her. She will make this available electronically, hopefully during the, well, I don't think it will be today, but it will be tomorrow. And if that is not the case, she'll email us or have a fax to you. Is that all right? But we can't pass it now. So we're going to go straight on to minutes. Now, we've had the minutes for 3 weeks, so we should be familiar with them. We were going to pass them last time, and we just never had the opportunity. The WHIP is at the strategic meeting right now, so he's unable to be here. We've got the 27th of July. So if you take those minutes out, and just look at them. Page 1. Please check to see if you were present and you marked absent, let us know. Page 2. Page 3. I realise that the new members cannot comment on this. They're not expected to. But we do need to vote here. These were studied. We got no response from the Democratic Party Alliance at all in respect of them, these particular texts of minutes. Can we have somebody propose the adoption? Only those present. Thank you. Honourable Kovasa, second. Honourable Lyon. Right. The 28th of July, page 1. page 2.
Could you just place my name and apologies on the first page?
Thank you. Page 2. Page 3. We have someone's proposed adoption for the minutes of the 28th of July. Honourable Lyon, Honourable Ndikalana, second. The 11th of August, the check for presence, apologies, etc. Page 1. Page 2. Pages there. We have someone to propose the adoption who was present. Honourable Kovasa proposes, seconded by only those present, of course, Honourable Lyon. 13th of August. On page 1, page 2, page 3. Right. We have somebody who was present. There were very few of us there, so this may pose a problem. Right. So please see who was present the 13th of August, and if you can propose, please do so. The members who were present was myself, Obasa, Kumalo, Mabasa, Adebe, and September. The present. Right, we can't. Kovasa proposes, we're unable to second them because we don't have anyone who's prepared to. Right, Wednesday the 18th, page 1. Page 2. We only have 2 there. There are only, again, very much the same people present, Sub, Kabasa, Kumalo, Ndikalana, Adebi, and Katimba. Page 1, right. We have somebody to propose adoption. Honourable Ndikalana. Seconding. Honourable Kapega. 25th of August. President Kabasa, Kumalo, Ndikalana, Kadevi, September, and Chula. Page 1. Page 2. Page 3. I don't think that I was in hospital then, so I can't even comment on whether they were correct or not. To anyone here, if the whip assured me that if he had nothing, he didn't find anything, I'm bored with that.
So I'm going to look the faster. Taking the time. I'm going to look the paper. Wednesday the 1st of September. Has everyone read these minutes, the 1st of September? We've all read them. Yes, Honourable Mann.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. Page 2 of the set of minutes from the 1st of September and the bullet point 1.4. The chairperson proposed that the trustee be established as you were matters arising from the report. I think there was a trustee established. So is it possible that we can mention the name under them? Thank you.
I haven't read the minutes because I came to the meeting then, but in between I was medically unavailable again. So, although I was present there, I think that we ought to leave these particular set of minutes so that they can be properly dealt with. Is that agreed? Right. Now, I'm going to, which set of minutes couldn't be adopted? The 17th. No, the 18th, the 13th. I'll read the people who were there again, and if you did read the minute, we need a seconder. I think Honourable Kabasa, you had proposed it. That was Sub Kabasa, Kumalo, Mabasa, Hadebe, September. So we've already gone page by page. Is there anyone prepared to propose adoption?
I did so earlier, really, Chair.
Right, thank you. I thought Kwabasa had proposed adoption of those. Thank you. Seconded? Kwabasa. They've all been passed with the exception of the 1st of September. I'm certainly going to take that into account, Honourable Lyon. I have to study my notes as well, so I don't want to shoot from the hip on this one, make a mistake. On that particular note, there's just one final thing, it's an invitation. The reason I mention it is I'm unable to attend. I'll be somewhere else overseas, and I'll be at another party commitment. It's the Africa Aerospace and Defense Expo, which allows us to also send, I can send someone else in my place. I have ascertained that the Honourable Albert is he is one of these hobbies or something. Is that aerospace or something? And then I thought we should use the Cape Town people largely, Honourable Connie September. I was suggesting yourself, and you could indicate if you are available to me and the Secretary afterwards. It is the 21st, 22nd, 23rd, and go on maybe a couple of Thursdays or what?
I'll come back to you, Chair, if I get.
That's what I'm suggesting.
That's my
idea. The only other one is that we thought of linking this to IT, where 3 people could be available there. But if that's not possible, we can leave it and send Honourable Elvis to box. Is that in order? I can't go, so you'll send yourself. Thank you very much. The reason we don't